Good morning also to members of the public. The Secretary of Police, the Secretariat, and also General Jacobs from SAPS. Before we start today's meeting, I think last week I did speak about the fact that as a committee we will have to apply our minds around rape and what we are going to do about it. I think since we spoke last week Tuesday, there's been further incidents in South Africa that seriously bring to light again the violence against women, femicide of women more often than not by the hands of their partners and family members. And I think as a committee we are expecting to, and it will be on our program, to get the 6 monthly reports on the Domestic Violence Act soon. I believe the first one is tabled and would be referred to us soon. I'm going to request in advance both the Secretariat and the Department to not come to that meeting simply giving us figures. The Act has been in place for so, so long, and it's time that we start evaluating the Act. It's time that we demand of the Department and of the Secretariat when they come with the Domestic Violence 6 monthly report, that they don't only come and give us figures, but that they tell us what needs to change in that Act to make it effective. Why is it that in South Africa, when we've got the Domestic Violence Act and the Firearms Act, we still have such situations where reports of domestic violence happen, and yet, in the end, that person against whom reports are made, the firearm is not taken away, and the end result is death. I think this committee has a responsibility to demand now action from SAPS, no longer excuses. We cannot tolerate the situation where this parliament, who represents the people of this country, put in place legislation to protect the people, but then because of not proper implementation of that legislation, it is not achieving what its original aim was. So I'm not fighting, I'm clearly just stating that this committee, when we deal with those reports, Secretary, through you, we are asking that we apply our minds on what is the problems around the legislation, and we are not taking training as an excuse anymore. I think also we need to start asking ourselves whether the woman's right or the victim's right to withdraw those cases after they've laid the complaint is not hindering the effectiveness of that legislation, and what would be the impact if we redress that specifically as well. Members, with that, I want to open the meeting. We are here to hear the public on the Dangerous Weapons Bill in front of us. Last week we did receive an introduction of the bill by the Minister, and as a committee we went through the bill with the Secretariat of Police as well as through our own researchers, so I presume that members are quite comfortable with the content of the bill. The procedures of the day, just for the members of the public who are going to make presentations, is that we would give you an opportunity of 15 minutes to make your presentation. Thereafter, we will open for questions of clarity. Members, I want to make it clear it's questions of clarity. We're not debating issues with the public. We are here to listen to what they say, clarity for ourselves so that we can discuss it when we start deliberating on the bill. After members have asked questions of clarity and the presenters have responded, I'm going to ask the department and secretariat if they want to add anything on a specific presentation. I think it's only fair so that the presenters also hear what the department's view on their presentation is at that point in time. I'm going to try and be quite strict to time because unfortunately we have a sitting this afternoon where all of us got to be, so there's no way that we can run over time. There will be attendance register going around. I please ask that all presenters make sure, and the people that are with you, that you do sign the register. It's important for our own records that we do have that as well. Our first presenter today is the Knife Makers Guild of Southern Africa. They've also asked me whether they can distribute a booklet because they couldn't add that in their presentation, and I've said it's fine, so members will get copies of that. We do have a committee assistant. I just sent him out quickly. When he comes back, you can give it to him and he can give it to the members. So over to yourself, sir, and if you can start by introducing yourself and your delegation. Thank you. You can sit down.
Thank you. Honourable Chairperson, esteemed members, and a special esteemed thank you to the Secretary Babalwa Mbengwe, who was very sympathetic with the Knife Makers Guild in the correspondence exchanged prior to this meeting. Thank you for an opportunity to be able to address the committee this morning. We regard it as a unique situation, a wonderful privilege to be here this morning. Thank you for that. Nicolette, if you could just pass on for us. The Knife Makers Guild does not have the footprint in South Africa that SAGA has, the South African Gun Owners Association, SAGA, NAGSA, and with the, I request your indulgence in just giving a short background of the Knife Makers Guild. The Knife Makers Guild of South Africa is an association of craftsmen established in 1980, almost 53 years ago, which has played a pivotal role in the establishment of an industry in South Africa centered around handmade knives as superior tools and art pieces, and the Knife Makers Guild continues to play a vital role in the development of this industry. As the Honourable Chairperson has indicated, I have annexures prepared annexures to the presentations, but unfortunately the PDF scanned copies that we've produced didn't reproduce the pages of our 30-year anniversary book satisfactorily, and I would just like, with the permission now of the Chair, to just circulate these three commemorative books to the members of the committee, because this gives a clearer understanding of the ethos, the culture of the Knife Makers Guild. This book was produced in commemoration of 30 years of knife making in South Africa, and the attachments are all reproduced in the book. Madam Chair, if you would please, when the assistant just makes an appearance again, just ask to assist me in distributing these, please. The Knife Makers Guild is composed of six classes of membership, founder members, of which there were three in 1980, voting members, 84, emeritus voting members, 3, associate members, 8, special non-voting members, 10, and honorary members, 13. Honorary members include also international figures, knife makers, collectors, and distributors, buyers, and sellers of knives. In Annexure C, there is a summary of the membership. Annexure C is not represented, but I have given you the figures now which relate to the different classes of membership. Currently there are 121 full-time members and associate members of the Knife Makers Guild. Nicolette, if you could just, next slide please. The knife making industry is in turn served by a fast developing industry which manufactures various types of specialized machinery and tools, with which to produce the products manufactured by the knife makers, but the industry also supplies specialized tools, equipment and materials which are required to embellish these products by way of engraving, scrimshanding, etching or carving. And these suppliers in turn offer employment to literally hundreds of individuals in the knife making industry. The Knife Makers Guild primarily serves the hunting and outdoors industry, the cutlery retail industry, the general public and collectors both local and abroad. The Knife Makers Guild has a database containing details of approximately 3,200 members, established and committed customers of the Knife Makers Guild. We have a very well organized database, and when these figures are presented to the honourable members of the committee, these are up-to-date figures. We have an annual Knife Makers Guild show at which the members participate, and the list of invitees to the annual show is a well-established, active and current list. So when we say 3,200 regular visitors to the show, that is a reliable reflection of the footprint of the Knife Makers Guild. The Knife Makers Guild was, as a voluntary association, established with a code of conduct, a constitution, and through the years the application and the regulation of the Guild has firmly established codes of conduct and traditions in the Knife Makers Guild, of which the record appears from the 30 years book, the 30 years of excellence, the commemorative book. Madam Chair, would it be in order if I just quickly handed out? I'm so anxious that the members and the Chair, of course, should see the commemorative book, because I think it is a good reflection of how the Guild conducts itself. The fact of the matter is, and a very practical fact, is that there are no known incidents of culpable or dangerous or criminal activity by any members of the Guild relating to dangerous weapons. It's also important to note that there are no known incidents of crimes committed with products produced and crafted by Guild members, either by the makers themselves, the clients of KGSA, or any other persons. And the reason for this is very obvious. And the reason why I say this, the products crafted and offered for sale by Guild members are invariably high-end products, which are more expensive, much more expensive than factory-produced knives, cutlery, axes, bongos, etc., which are easily available from a wide range of shops and suppliers, as the honourable members and the honourable chair will see from the commemorative book. These products are not required for illegitimate use. These products are for use by the discerning hunter, fisherman, outdoorsman, cooks, for culinary purposes, collectors, businessmen, or simply by enthusiasts who collect these products for investment value. The Knife Makers Guild has international recognition, is highly regarded as a guild of specialists with a very high profile internationally, and really boasts some of the most gifted craftsmen and talented artists in the world. In fact, I was just commenting to some of my friends who are here among the presenters this morning, that we have permanent commissions. One of the members is a permanent exhibitionist in the Fine Arts Museum in New York, for instance, for certain designs and the quality of his work. Now, Annexure D lists the names of Knife Makers Guild members with membership of international guilds and an array of international awards received by these members. If I may then just refer the chair and the honourable members to the last two pages inside of the commemorative book. That is a reflection of the formidable and impressive list of international awards received by Guild members. The Knife Makers Guild, over the three decades of its existence, has established itself as a proud and very honourable institution. The Knifemakers Guild specific comments I have purposely just passed over one of the earlier slides. Nicolette, you don't have to move towards that, but I just want to alert the Honourable Chair and Committee members to the fact that I was not expecting to open the proceedings today, and in our presentation I referred and relied quite heavily on the SAACA, South African Arms and Ammunition Collectors Confederation of South Africa, and specifically curtailed the content of the Knifemakers Guild representations in order to not overburden these proceedings with bilateral comments. So if the Honourable Chair and Committee members would just bear with me, if I ask you to just keep in mind the comments which we make today, and to see these comments as supplementary to the comments to be made later by the representative of SAACA, and then also deem these comments which I make today to be incorporated into the SAACA presentation when it is delivered to the committee later. And moving on then to the Knifemakers Guild specific comments, when one looks at Section 1 of the draft bill at this point in time, what the Knifemakers Guild needs to say specifically this morning is that we support and regard the draft bill in its present form as a well thought through and a prudent piece of legislation, and the suggestions we make today is not to be seen or intended as criticism, but as an honest effort to assess the legislature to eventually achieve a dispensation in which weapons which do pose, or instruments which do pose a potential danger to members of the public, to be properly regulated. The Knifemakers Guild has no quarrel with legislation which is that as the ultimate goal. So the Honourable Committee members and Madam Chair, if you would just in your mind take the edges off some of the statements which were made. It's always easier to make sharp-edged comments when one submits in writing representations, but today I wish you to consider what I say with the specific mindset that we are here to make a contribution to what is already a winning cause. And what we intend to achieve is to find certainty at street level, clearly and simply where law enforcement reaches the pavement, at street level where in the mind of the law enforcer, who by the very nature of his or her profession will invariably have to exercise discretion under pressure, interfaces with the average citizen who invariably feels threatened by any form of law enforcement, and without the edge of criticism, we are in a dispensation, I honestly believe, objectively speaking, where the average citizen does feel vulnerable when subjected to law enforcement activities. What we would like to see eventually is legislation which is clear enough to enable the law enforcer to not have to grapple with intangible principles, to practically and clearly and effectively do law enforcement, and to not have a dispensation where a member of the public who for legitimate reasons is in possession or transports objects which do fall within the definition of dangerous weapon as it currently appears in the bill is not uncertain of his or her situation and whether he or she, if eventually subjected to law enforcement, is for some reason in an area of risk and of potential confrontation with a law enforcer. So with that in mind, the Knife Makers Guild wishes to say that in its present form, the definition of a dangerous weapon in Section 1 of the Bill objectively and unreasonably encroaches upon the constitutional rights of members, simply because every product manufactured by guild members for sale to their customers is capable of being classified as an unlawful dangerous weapon. And if we could then just move on, Nicolette, please. Consequently, the Knife Makers Guild specifically subscribes to NARCSA's proposed amplification of the definition of dangerous weapon in Section 1 of the Dangerous Weapon Bill to provide that only, and the section that we propose should be introduced, in inverted commas, it only objects designed or adapted for use as a weapon and capable of causing death or inflicting serious bodily harm are included in the definition. The products crafted by guild members, even though designed as a weapon and capable of producing death or serious bodily harm, are never intended for use as a weapon. And the track record of the Knife Makers Guild endorses the statement and supports, as I say, objectively. But these instruments are almost exclusively used as tools for display or as objects with investment value. More importantly, as I remarked earlier, there's no record of the products produced by Knife Makers Guild members, even though designed as a weapon and capable of producing death or serious bodily harm, ever having been used in the commission of crimes. And these products must be clearly distinguished from weapons generally found to be used in the commission of crimes. The practical difficulty that arises is that the inexperienced law enforcement officers might not upon visual inspection be able to make this distinction between these products crafted by guild members and weapons generally found to be used in the commission of crimes. But that then brings us to Section 2 of the Dangerous Weapon Bill. And from the perspective of the Knife Makers Guild, in Section 2, one of subsection 1 of the Bill, by use of the wording may raise a reasonable suspicion, the Minister confers an unacceptably wide and subjective discretion upon the law enforcement officer engaged in law enforcement, and as I pointed out earlier, in circumstances which would invariably a high-pressure situation, not only for the law enforcer, but also for the citizens subjected to the law enforcement exercise. And the definition is not sufficiently clearly defined so as to protect the interests of a person who does not intend to use the object in question for an unlawful purpose. The South African Arms and Ammunition Confederation, Collectors Confederation of South Africa, NARCSA, proposes a refinement of the wording of Section 3. They propose three possible scenarios of, and at the time of presenting preparing my representation, my submissions today, I was not aware of the second and third options included. This presentation suggests that Section 2 of the Dangerous Weapon Bill should place a stricter duty of care upon law enforcement officers to ensure that circumstances exist that justify the reasonable and necessary inference that the person subjected to the law enforcement exercise intends to use such a dangerous weapon for an unlawful purpose. If I may respectfully refer you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee to the wording proposed by SAKA, we believe that the third proposal submitted by NARCSA contains an even more practical suggestion. And this is that the wording of Section 2, Subsection 1, should be amended, adjusted to read as follows. Any person who is in possession of a dangerous weapon and the circumstances that justify a conclusion beyond reasonable doubt that such a person intends using a dangerous weapon for an unlawful purpose is guilty of an offence. It is a principle which I think, and I can confidently submit to the committee today, has been tested in the courts and is a definition with which not only the law enforcer but the average citizen would be comfortable. Members of the South African Police Services are trained.
You've got 3 minutes left.
Thank you, ma'am. Only to allow the exercise of a discretion, which is clearly defined, and in a great many instances, these members are not equipped to deal with the interpretation and application of statutory provisions which allow too wide a discretion, and the interpretation of sophisticated constitutional principles. And the law enforcer should not be required to exercise discretion at such a wide and undefined level. The Knife Makers Guild, if I, in view of the time constraint, what I would wish, if I may just ask you to move ahead, Nicolette, I will tell you where to stop. We have, just move on, just one back, please. The KGSA accreditation, the Knife Makers Guild wishes to suggest that the legislation be modified and perhaps amplified to provide a dispensation where members of established bodies, voluntary associations of people with a proven track record, a reliable record of internal discipline and regulation be allowed accreditation, where a member who is in possession of a membership card, such as we have with the South African Arms and Ammunition Collectors at the moment, South African Hunters, would then at street level have the recognition and be easily recognized as a person who is not at risk to the members of the general public. And with that then, I would distinguish to thank the committee once again for the opportunity of making these submissions. The Knife Makers Guild is a well-established, honourable organisation which really appreciates the opportunity of being allowed to give verbal submissions which we believe should assist in the formulation of effective legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very much. I'm going to give an opportunity to members for questions of clarity. Can I get an indication of hands, Ms. Molobatsi? Mr. Legetu, Mr. Law, in that order, please.
Thank you, Chair.
Can I just ask that you switch off your microphone and that you make notes of the questions? We will come back to you once to answer.
Thank you, Chair. Let me thank the presenter for his presentation. My question is very short. It's on the definition of dangerous weapons. You said in your input the definition in its present form encroaches upon the constitutional rights of the members of KGSA. Now, my question is, how what is your advice to that effect? What is your advice? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Your membership, thanks for the presentation. Your membership is 121, and I'm saying this number is very exclusive. The booklet here demonstrates the exclusivity, because here I see mostly white faces. You have black membership. The second question, Chair. You say the draft bill is a thoughtful, it's well thought, and I am very happy to hear those words from you. They are very encouraging. Thanks, Chair.
Logo?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let us go to the presentation on page 4, or page 6 of the presentation. I just want to ask on paragraph 35. I want to understand the paragraph. What does it mean? It's under Section 2 of the Dangerous Weapons Bill. What does it mean? If you can just elaborate on it, it will make it easier. I don't want to read it because it will waste a lot of time, because I'm not a good reader on it.
No. Hold on, please, sir. Please, as said, make notes of the questions. He is talking from page 5, paragraph 25.
Page 6.
Page 6.
Paragraph 35.
Sorry, 35.
Yeah. I just want to understand that paragraph. Page 6, paragraph 35. The second one, Chairperson, is page 7, paragraph 40. Can you just elaborate on that paragraph again? And the last one is page 7 again, paragraph 42. If you can just elaborate on those three paragraphs for me, so that I will understand exactly what you are referring to. Thanks.
Ms. Kulabana, Ms. Malabatsi, Mr. Mulelengi Jordan.
Yes, thank you very much for your presentation. I want to refer particularly to your page 8, 44. And I, in my readings of the proposed the clause 2, for example, of the bill, I believe it may answer your objection, because this objection, the reason this was withdrawn and has now been reintroduced is it seemed to, or definitely did, take away people's rights to self-defense. Had a huge impact on gaming, even possession was suddenly criminalized. That all went away, and the aim is to protect citizens against being attacked by a weapon of any description. Now, it says here in Clause 2 of it, under possession of the weapon under circumstances which may raise a reasonable suspicion that the person intends to use the dangerous weapon, firearm, or anything else for unlawful purposes. Now, surely, your claim here that there can be no basis for criminalizing the possession of any object without any corresponding or criminal intent, I believe is answered there. I'd just like some input on that. Do you find the wording upsetting in some way, threatening? I don't know, but I thought that it handled it quite clearly, that one may possess whatever you want, but if you pick it up and go to stab someone, it's now a dangerous weapon, and you will be arrested. So I'm not sure if you could just elaborate on why you have an objection in that area. Thank you very much.
Honourable Mulabatsi.
Thank you, Chairperson. As I'm looking at this book here, what comes to mind is all these weapons, well, all these knives have got sharp edges, which says they can kill. Now, my question is, before you sell these knives, do you have a procedure where you maybe first satisfy yourself that it is going to be used for a good purpose, or do you have that? Thanks, Chair.
Honourable George.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And thank you very much, the presenter. You say you're selling these knives and weapons only to your member. Now, my question is, are your members, once they become your member, are they definitely members until death? What happens to a member when he's no longer a member of an association? He's already got the weapons. That's number one. Number two, do you have measures to make sure that these weapons, in senior members are kept safe. You know, if you are given a firearm, one of the requirements is to make sure that you've got a safe so that nobody else can have an access to that firearm. And these weapons, do you have some measurements, right, to make sure that your members keep them safe so that other elements who might not be like your members, as you are saying, who might be of criminal orientation, might not have access to these weapons? That's my question. The other question, you complained, right, about the definition. And I was trying to read if you have presented an alternate definition, which I didn't see you doing it. You see, so those are my questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Stubber. That's the last question I'm taking from members. Honourable Stubber.
Thank you, Chair. What I want to know is, am I right to say that all your members started the trade of knife making as a hobby, and subsequent it evolved in becoming a master knife maker, and because some people collect knives, that they make knives for the market, but exclusive, not on mass production. And that anybody belonging to your organization need to adhere to a certain standard to be allowed to be on the Guild of Knife Makers. Thank you.
You can respond, sir, and can I ask you to keep your answers to the point, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Please forgive me. Unfortunately, my bundle is not marked pages and paragraphs. So I might be missing the mark with regard to certain of the paragraphs which were not dealt with verbally by the honourable members, but I will deal with the questions as clearly as I can. With regard to question one, the advice on how to address the definition and section 2.1, the wording that is subscribed to and supported by the South African Knife Makers Guild is intended not to change the content of the definition itself, but to find a way at street level to make the implementation of the definition more clear, so that when one looks at general principles, the application of the practical implementation by a law enforcer is made easier. The discretion which needs to be exercised is not as wide. The definition is more clear. But the content of the legislation we support, it's simply the mechanism by which the law enforcement eventually is conducted. Honourable Member, with regard to the sifting process of the sales, this is the second question by the same honourable member. Yes, the Knife Makers Guild has a record. The members have records and submit on a regular basis to the executive of the Knife Makers Guild records of sales, the type of knives, so we, and the, also the general cost. We have, at meetings of the Knife Makers Guild, clearly displayed indications, placards, printed boards, that the products are not on sale to individuals below the age of 18 unless supervised by parents. And there is certainly a sifting process in general. If I may then just jump to the sixth question, which I just want to deal with in this vein. The Knife Makers Guild did start off, the three founder members, in fact, were hobbyists. But since over the 3-decade lifespan of the guild, we have a number of members who have taken up the profession from the start as full-time knife makers. So the feeding area into the Knife Makers Guild now is not necessarily from the hobbyist environment. The process whereby people are taken up into apprenticeships, not only for the manufacturing of knives but also for the embellishment, has become a very common testing ground, developing ground for skills development in members serving the Knife Makers Guild. The number of members in the guild, although only sir numbering 121, serve a huge slice of the community. The list of customers, 3,200 which we have, are repeat purchasers and people who are known by name, address and telephone number to the members of the guild. And these are not the incidental purchases of knives. So although the guild has, on the face of it, only a small membership, it has a huge impact in the community. The guild membership includes Chupanian Corsi, who is a black scrimshander and artist of international standard. We do have members of the coloured communities. Mohammedi is one of our premier and well-recognized and respected members of the guild. And there is absolutely no restriction and encouragement also for anybody who wishes to introduce him or herself into the ranks of guild membership to do so. It's just not, I think, within the contemplation of the average citizen to become a professional knife maker. It is not a recognized general profession such as one of the standard trades. But we are delighted that we now, in fact, do have representation across race groups. The sifting of sales and safekeeping, by the very nature of the product which the Knife Makers Guild presents for sale, it results in these products not being left unattended in the normal course of events. For instance, you would find that the knife collectors would never have their knives other than properly locked away in safekeeping under lock and key, simply because of the value of these instruments. And although per se these weapons are capable eventually of producing serious injury or death, I would stress the point that these instruments, these objects, are never made with the intention of being used for that purpose eventually. And Madam Chair, please forgive me, members, if I perhaps have missed out on one of the questions, but I believe I have dealt with the questions.
The Honourable and Lawless questions on the different paragraphs.
I'm sorry, could I just ask for a quick repeat of the question, please forgive me.
Please, I'm going to ask our presenters to take note. We are following your presentation as it was given to us. I'm going to ask the presenters to take note of the questions so that we don't run into repetitions. It was page 6, section 2 of the Dangerous Weapons Bill, 35. Your whole argument there around it does not intend to use the object in question for an unlawful purpose, that one. And then paragraph 40 on page 7. Yet such a law enforcement officer will be empowered to exercise on the street unfettered discretion. The member wants an explanation of that paragraph. And I think it's specifically because a reasonable suspicion is a legal term that is accepted in our courts as well. So you need an explanation on that. And then 42 is the question of the discretion of any law enforcement officer, even incompetently, unreasonably or maliciously exercised, may result in an unjust arrest and criminal prosecution. Those were the three paragraphs. Ms. Kulabarnat, is there a question from you?
Mine was 32, number 32, and there's the one I referred to the design for use as a weapon, etc., and said, was that not already answered by the way it was phrased in the bill?
Can you quickly respond to those three, please? And can I ask you again that you keep to the point as of your argument, please?
Please forgive me, Madam Chair. Simply the wording which it currently reads may raise a reasonable suspicion is a very subjective test, and we believe that in a situation where pressure is experienced by nature of the law enforcement exercise, the interface between law enforcer and the average citizen subjected to law enforcement creates an atmosphere of pressure, that the definition should simply be clearer to make the exercise of the discretion of the law enforcer easier. It's not to hamper the content or the practical effect of the bill, but simply the implementation of the bill at street level to create certainty in the mind of the law enforcer and also the citizens subjected to the law enforcement exercise. Madam Chair, I think I will then just stay with these submissions.
Members, can we take that? Because I think the presenter also indicated that some of his concerns will be addressed by other presenters later during the day. So let's keep to that. I want to give the department an opportunity to respond to some of the issues that has been raised. If you want to clarify some issues, I'll give you the opportunity now. Can I again ask that we keep it short and concise?
Thank you, Chair. I think it's obvious that we will look at the definition, so I'll not spend time on that. I just want to make an observation that I also made at the previous meeting, and that is that we will definitely look at the exercising of the discretion by the police officer, and that we have looked at proposals that we want to make to the committee relating to the pursuit of any lawful employment, duty or activity, participation in any lawful sport, recreation or entertainment, or the legitimate collection, display, or exhibition of weapons. And I think that will address a lot of these concerns that have been mentioned. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. So thank you very much for the presentation. We appreciate the time that you've taken to come and contribute in this debate. As you heard, your issues will be taken on board, also by the committee when we start discussing the issues. Can I ask you to switch off your microphone, please? I'm now calling the Gauteng Airsoft Club. Are they here? Can you come to the front, please? Yeah, sit here. Can I ask the people that just presented to just move away? Copies. Nicolette, we've got copies of the presentation, so it's fine. Can I ask, please, for the presenters, even though it's obviously interesting for us to know more about where you come from and that we want you to do that, but to spend time on the content of the bill, please, because, I mean, in the end, that's what where we need your input and submissions as well. You can start, please. Please introduce yourself and your team.
Thank you, Honourable Members and Madam Chair. We represent the Gauteng Airsoft Club. Myself is Alexander Matthew. We've got Dr. André Duplessis. Just want to make an apology for Tyron Wild that couldn't make it due to travel complications. We just quickly do a very brief overview. What is Airsoft in South Africa? And then we'll give over to Dr. Duplessis to handle our submissions and concerns regarding the bill. So I'm going to do a brief overview of Airsoft. Airsoft is a sport we practice in South Africa. It's a recreational activity where the participants eliminate their opponents with spherical non-metallic pellets. That's round little BBs launched from replica firearms. The sport is internationally recognized. It started in Japan in the early 70s to allow military and reenactment enthusiasts to enjoy owning and handling imitation firearms, since real gun ownership in those countries are prohibited. To make the weapons legal in those areas, they were specifically designed to be unable to be converted or to fire any real ammunition. The sport has since spread to all parts of the world. It's extremely big in the Americas, Europe, and it's recently come to our shores. If you go to the next slide, please. Different game types we do. Short-term skirmishes, close-quarter battles, military simulations, historical reenactments, and speed shooting. We are very, very strict on our safety rules at all our events and with all our members. Safety begins with the pellet itself. It's a non-toxic, non-metallic, spherical ball. The caliber is 6mm and the maximum permissible velocity of 500 feet per second, or 2.3 joules, of kinetic energy results in a replica firing a pellet that can't penetrate the body, or even if fired at very close range. The maximum effective range of the airsoft rifles is between 70 and 80 meters in good weather. And airsoft guns are usually made of aluminium or plastic, which, if not handled carefully, could break if dropped. Regarding the safety, we're very, very strict about it in our games and events, that the protective eyewear is essential for both participants and spectators. All games include safety briefings. It's mandatory that all the members attend the safety briefing before each game, and it includes procedures if someone during the game takes off eye protection and such. You can see our submissions of the safety rules. We've got a code of conduct with the Gauteng Airsoft Club, and all of our members are made aware of it before each game. It includes the endorsement of responsible gun ownership, and we treat and respect them as real firearms. We stipulate also the transportation of these devices to and from games must be conducted in the same way you would transport a real firearm. We also support the SAPS in stating that we do not endorse displaying or carrying an airsoft gun or rifle in public. Last 2 points. What we want to make is that airsoft guns, as you can see stated on this slide, they're made to look similar to the real thing. But if you look at the price levels, the guns usually start from entry-level airsoft gun, about 1,600 rand, as you can see on top, and competition, race spec, target shooting pistols to about to the sum of 22,000 rand. So with that, we believe, given the high cost of the guns, if a criminal has the money to possess, and he would rather, if he has the money to purchase it with the intention to commit a crime, for less money we'd be able to get a real firearm. Airsoft in South Africa started in 2007 in Cape Town, when Cape Town hosted the first national airsoft competition where 20 players attended. It's open to all races and sexes, though we do require parental permission for minors to participate. Currently, Gauteng Airsoft has more than 1,500 members on its website, and we host games almost every weekend with attendance between 80 to 100 players. We've hosted games up to 120 players. That's some of our biggest. There are links, everything on our website as supplied. In the photos supplied, you can see we have got a full, throughout the spectrum of the country, we've got everyone partaking. I'd like to give to André du Plessis to go further with our recommendations. Thank you.
Honourable Chairs and Honourable Members, good morning. I'm briefly going to deal on four concerns and then possible proposed recommendations in regards to the Dangerous Weapons Bill. Our first concern stems from Section 1 in the definitions of the Dangerous Weapons Bill, where all air guns is classed with the definition of a firearm in the Dangerous Weapons Bill. So when the Dangerous Weapons Bill then refers to a firearm, it also refers to an air gun as outlined in the Firearms Control Act of 2000. Now, the air gun is defined in the Firearms Control Act as a device discharging a bullet or other projectile by means of compressed air, less than 8 joules of kinetic energy, or a caliber less than 5.6 millimeters. Now, in reality, that wording in its current form would mean that any form of air gun would be seen under the Dangerous Weapons Bill as part of the firearms definition. And in a sense, then, you would have a Nerf gun, which is in the bottom lower corner of the presentation, classed in exactly the same manner as a high-energy air gun on the right. Now, this was the problem because this thing clearly places the airsoft devices in a category that it was never meant to be used for. So our first recommendation in this regard would be that it is clear then basically that an airsoft rifle or gun does not fall within the definition of a firearm, and it's recommended that the definition of firearm in Section 1 of the revised Dangerous Weapons Bill be amended by adding the following wording, but excluding a device in the nature of an air gun in which the bullet or other projectile is discharged at the maximum muzzle energy of less than 2.3 joules. We can have the next slide, please. Our second area of concern is the concept of an imitation firearm or replica, which is also defined in terms of Section 1 of the revised bill. And it's defined in the Weapons Control Act as the definition refers to as the Firearms Control Act. And this definition then covers anything that has the appearance of a firearm but that is not capable of operating as a firearm and cannot be officially examined or be identified then as a firearm. So as a first point, we would just like to reaffirm that an airsoft gun is not capable of operating as a firearm and it's not capable of expelling a bullet or projectile with more than 8 joules. It's just physically not possible with the bolts of the device. So we would like to propose that an amendment of the revised bill may be considered by the honourable members, and that is by amending the definition of imitation firearm to provide a further test in addition to superficial examination how to distinguish from these rifles. If I can just point to the bottom two pictures, the magazine on the left is a normal handgun magazine. It clearly seen that it contains bullets or casings, and the device on the right is an airsoft handgun magazine, and it can be clearly seen that by examining those two pieces, there should be no discrepancy even for a layperson to distinguish between the devices. So our recommendation would then be, in order to make it clear that an airsoft gun can be identified as a mere imitation, it is then recommended that the definition of imitation firearm is revised to read as follows. An imitation firearm means an imitation firearm is defined in Section 1 of the Firearms Control Act, such superficial examination to include an examination of the magazine of the device and its contents, and then replica to mean the same. So our basic submission in this area is that it is clear that by examining the magazine, it is clear that that rifle is not a real firearm. Secondly, I just want to point out to the previous bill, although the previous bill made a possible differentiation by means of color spray, this has been removed in the current bill, and although it is a matter of possible differentiation, the only real differentiation would be by examining the magazine. If you can move on to the next slide, please. Our third concern is referred to Section 2, which is the position prohibition section. And The issue here is that the Dangerous Weapons Bill sets out the relevant factors without limiting the factors that must be taken into account in determining whether a person intends to use an imitation firearm for unlawful purposes. And we now propose that another such factor, as outlined in Section 2.2 of the Dangerous Weapons Bill, could be an inspection of the magazine of the airsoft gun or device and the ammunition or the BBs held there within. So our recommendation 3 in this regard would be that in order to ensure that a person in possession of an airsoft gun will not be held to contravene Section 2.1, it's recommended that subsection 2.2 be amplified by introducing two further factors to be taken into account, namely whether the imitation firearm bears a distinctive color or marking to identify it as an airsoft gun. Let me just say at this point that some of the airsoft devices available in Africa today is sold with a pre-colored tip, red tip, to indicate, but that's not all the devices. And secondly, whether an inspection of the magazine of the imitation firearm shows that it is intended merely to hold airsoft ammunition and not real ammunition. We can move on to the next slide, please. The last area of concern and recommendation in regards to Section 4, the regulation of gatherings. Now, and in our main submission, as well as our supplement submission, which we should have before you, we propose that Section 8.4 of the Regulations of Gathering Act should be amplified to exclude also gatherings for purposes of recognized sporting activity, in addition to the gatherings for religious purposes or historical enactments. Now, our recommendation 4 would be that a further reference to sporting activities be inserted into the qualifying paragraph of revised Section 8.4 to basically state in the following manner: after the words "during a gathering or demonstration for cultural or religious purposes or historical enactments," to insert the words "or recognized sport activity." However, we wish to record our understanding of the meaning of gathering in this instance as that the Act, or the Gatherings Act, states that it's namely for the example of purpose to discuss, to attack, to criticize, to promote, or propagate the principles or policy, action, or failure of Act to government. And in our interpretation, that should basically exclude our airsoft events. Since our events are for purely recreational and sporting activity, it does not have any political or motivational views. Can we have the next slide, please? So just in summary, our concerns stem not from the opposition of what the bill is trying to achieve. We actually support it, and we think it is a good step forward in safety in our community. The problem for us is that the possibility that an airsoft player on his way to or from a game could be in contravention of the law simply by having an airsoft gun in his possession. Just to clarify the statement, very often when we do an airsoft game, there's multiple people involved. It might be at night. You may be dressed in camo clothing, and then traveling in a car, a couple of people, camo clothing with an airsoft device in the car, can raise possible suspicions when stopped. So we just want to ensure that in our normal operation of our sport, we are not hampered as such. And if there's a better way of to word that, or how we requested possible assistance, then without lessening the impact of the bill, we will surely support it. Thank you for your time.
Members, questions from your side? Questions of clarity? I see Ms. Kulavar not.
Thank you. I just from the pictures I've seen, I mean, some of them are very obviously gaming guns. One wouldn't mistake it, but there are presumably others that are closer to replicas. I mean, I think we must understand that we cannot, as Parliament, allow unintended consequences for something we pass. The aim is not to shut down anybody's business or have an impact on a sport or anything. We're looking at protecting citizens. And as such, when this was presented, I asked the department, I'm hoping they will actually give us the exact references today. The business of the gathering, and I mean, it just uses the word gathering, but I was assured the term gathering was defined elsewhere in another bill to refer to a political gathering or protest. I believe that would, but I think the definition will clarify that. And look, it could be a problem, even without this bill passed, that your guys are traveling around in camouflage carrying weapons. I mean, never mind this Hello. Today could be a problem. I'm presuming you carry some sort of identification or something that proof. To date, you've had no problems with being stopped and hauled into cells because you've got plastic guns. I don't think this bill has any intention of changing that possibility. I'm very keen to hear the exact reference to the gathering issue, because it's going to be an issue not only for you, but for anyone, I mean, competitive knife fighting, kung fu training with a sword, you know, many gatherings could be, but it's not what is intended, and the reference was made very clear to us last week. So I think you might find that issue clarified when they come to us. Thank you.
Any other questions? I must be honest. We never legislate for law-abiding citizens. The fact of the matter is that there are people, and we know of the incident in Mpumalanga about 2 weeks back, where similar kind of weapons were used in attacking a group of people. I'm not saying, you know, there was no reason, there was a fight and everything else, but the fact of the matter is these weapons are being abused. We cannot deny that. And I think that's where the legislation comes in, is when even your members are abusing those firearms, this bill will allow that they be acted upon. I mean, as it is, without this bill, they can be acted upon in any case for that specific incident. But it just makes it clear, because your scenario of sketching people in camouflage on their way at night, with all due respect, as a law-abiding citizen, I would want the police to stop them. I honestly would want the police to stop them. I would honestly want the police to make sure where they are going and what they have with them. And if that's a discomfort at that point, then that's the price you pay for the sport you're practicing. But in the end, the police's responsibility is broader than just making sure that people can get comfortably to a situation and that they turn a blind eye, not knowing what the intention is. My other concern is, and I think that is where presenters are still missing the point of this legislation. It's not illegalizing what you are doing currently. Not at all. It is illegalizing the abuse of that. The same with the knife makers. Same with them. It's not making it illegal, but it is saying using that weapon, however expensive it is, we've seen and we know crime is not only committed by the poor, is to make that illegal. And what do we expect, and I'm worried about this thing about reasonable suspicion and that people question this. What do we expect of SAPS if in a gathering one of these replica firearms are being used by somebody and they are subsequently unintended consequences? So I would like to just hear you on these, because these are the concerns that we need to look at. We need to look at the abuse of what is legally there.
Madam Chair and members, I'm going to respond to the first question. It's true. Some of the devices are more obvious than not to be replicas, and some are obvious that they are replicas. The problem for us is that, first of all, let me state that we fully support the fact that if any replica, whether it being an airsoft device or whatever other replica it may be, if it's used in an unlawful act, that should be acted upon without any doubt. And I think that also touches partly on the second question. The problem that we want just to prevent is that we, in our ordinary way of doing our sport, is not hampered. And that's why we specifically stated to the concept of superficial investigation. The Dangerous Weapons Bill currently states that in order to see if it's a replica or not, it entails superficial examination. And for us, that is a very vague term. Is that only visual evaluation? Does that also mean that you can handle the device and take out the magazine. Now, obviously, in any situation where, for instance, there is a replica in a crowd being pointed, that would definitely fall within Section 2.1, and that person would be liable under the bill. What we just want to prevent is I don't want to travel back from a game having the devices in my vehicle being stopped by SAPS and then said, look, this is a dangerous thing, we're going to arrest you. So we just want to implement a way that is within reason for the SAPS to just evaluate and see this is obviously not used in a manner to define unlawful purpose, but we want to include the fact that they must just evaluate and see, not on superficial inspection, but just to evaluate the magazine. That's first question one. The second question in regards to the gatherings, the scenario that you painted, Honourable Madam Chair, is clearly one of demonstration where there was political activists most of the time with a gun in a scenario or a gun in a crowd. We don't subscribe to that, and any person like that obviously would fall under the bill. Although we're fairly sure that our activity when we play an airsoft match doesn't fall under the Regulations Gathering Act because we don't have a political purpose or a motivation to state or comment on anything. It's purely for recreation. We might feel it prudent if we just include the section for relevant sporting activity. A demonstration obviously is not a sporting activity, so that would fall outside our recommendation. Thank you.
You see, I think the scenarios we sketched are maybe too simple. Now, your request is that the SAPS must inspect and then only decide. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. SAPS is patrolling, and there's a person in a private yard with one of these firearms. Under this legislation, that is suspicious. And inspecting whether it is an airsoft gun or not does not take away the suspicion, because the people inside the house, when that person enters the house, will not know that it is a toy or a sports gun. So I think we need to address the concerns, and it's actually something that committee members raised last week already, that we want to include sporting events. We want to include that. We've made it clear last week already. While we have to do that, and we agree with that, we cannot take away from the scenarios that can play out. And I think that we all need to be understand as well. SAPS would also be irresponsible to allow that person, even after inspection, that they found 3 o'clock in the morning in a private estate or in a house or wherever else, to continue after they've inspected and saw that it is an ordinary game file. And I think that is what we're trying to balance out here. And I would ask presenters also to keep that in mind. But we'll look at the definitions. Anything from the department side? Can you clarify the issue on the gatherings as well? Can I just say to the presenters as well, you must also remember that we say gathering, but that same scenario can happen at Loftus-Versfeld, where a person is showing this firearm that they use for soft gun. So it's not only at political gatherings where it becomes an issue. It's the use of it at places where it should not be. That's the problem.
Chairperson, members of the committee, just before General Jacobs explains the Gathering Act, I just wanted to raise one issue that was raised about inspecting the gun and the colour. There's nothing to stop you from spray painting a real gun. And in fact, nowadays, you get women's guns in pink and all different colours, so they don't look like a gun. So to actually ask the police to look at the colouring of the gun isn't necessarily going to work, because then people will paint their real guns into other colours. I think the General Jacobs has already referred to the sporting issue, but I'll ask him to just clarify exactly what the section of the dangerous gatherings is.
Thank you, Chair. The gatherings definition in the Regulation of Gatherings Act is any assembly, concourse, or procession of more than 15 persons on any public road or any other public place or premises, wholly or partly open to the air, and what's then important, at which the principles, policy, actions,
or failure to act of any government, political party or political organization, whether or not that party organization is registered, is discussed, attacked, criticized, promoted or propagated. And the second part of the definition reads very much the same. It must be a sort of a protest gathering. Chair, and I can just mention, the police has in many instances arrested people, a group of robbers. I have a newspaper report here, for example. The group of robbers was arrested with a shotgun, revolver and a toy gun. Now, we won't really have any statistics to say in how many instances toy guns have actually been used in crime like robberies. But, Chair, I think the observations of the Secretary as well, that I think we didn't really go into the exercise of regulating toy guns and soft air guns and all those things. But we agree with what the Chair has said, that it depends on what is the motive or the, with what intent the purpose the person want to use that gun. And I think we have many instances where these toy guns actually were totally abused. And then I also agree, Chair, with the responsible behavior. I also think to drive in a car at night with camouflage, and I think one of the issues that can be that if these airsoft guns are being transported, that they be put in bags in the back of the car, and then you can explain to the police officer, look, we are on our way to do this and this, and these toy or these airsoft guns are in the back and they can be inspected and whatever. I think one has to mitigate the risks yourself as well.
But from you, I want to move on to the next presenter, please.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Let me just allow to respond to the gun colour. That's indeed true. I mean, any gun can be painted anyway, and just by painting it, the red doesn't make it a non-firearm. And that is the reason why we want to try and emphasise the fact that superficial examination, just by looking at it, is a very is a very non-specific evaluation method. That's why we wanted specifically to just add our comments on the magazine evaluation. I can just add on a matter of transport, we do obviously recommend all our members that when any assault devices travel to and from a game, that it should be in a bag, in the boots, not displayed publicly. So we, as Gauteng Airsoft Club, and thereby presenting the Airsoft Players Africa, would make it, well, we just want to reiterate that the bill in itself we don't oppose. When any such device is used in an illegal manner or on an unlawful practice, whether it's 3 o'clock in the morning in somebody else's yard, that intent is obvious. The unlawful intent is there. We just want to ensure that by doing our normal activity in a private place, that we will not be encroached on. And I think that is the gist of our submission. Thank you.
That's the assurance we're giving you. That won't happen. It is the unattended use, the people that use it or abuse it rather, that will suffer the consequences. In exercising your sport, that's not, and you will not be in that with this legislation.
Thank you, Manager.
Members, I just want to check whether the tea is there before we take the next group. Otherwise, I would like us to break for tea. I just want to make sure. Otherwise, we're going to stop right in the middle, and I don't want to do that. Secretary is just checking for us, so if you just bear with me for a minute. Let's continue with the presentation, please. I see they're taking too long in there. Where she comes now. Is it there, Babelwa? Is it Babelwa? Is it there? Is it ready? Okay, let's continue with the presentation. We can break after the presentation, come back and ask questions. So the next presentation is by the National Arms and Ammunition Collectors Confederation of South Africa. Can you please move to the front? You can start. Please start by introducing yourself.
Jay, good morning, and thank you for this opportunity, and greetings to yourself and to the honourable members.
I'm Carver Webb, Chairman of the National Arms and Ammunition Collectors Confederation of South Africa, and on my left is Bruce Shaw, one of my executive committee members based here in the Cape. Chair, if we can look at the contents of the presentation, I will touch briefly on the focus, a brief introduction to Naloxone, Chair, will be brief. The artifacts from a collector's point of view which we feel are affected by the Dangerous Weapons Bill, three detailed concerns and proposals, and a conclusion. The focus of our presentation, I want to make it clear from the outset that NARCSA supports the revised Dangerous Weapons Bill, but we believe that there are three issues which require some refinement. What is NARCSA? The National Arms and Ammunition Collectors Confederation of South Africa, it's a bit of a mouthful, is the umbrella body for accredited collectors' associations in South Africa as envisaged in Regulation 51C of the Firearms Control Act. It was born out of the 1998 Collectors Forum, and when it became clear that an umbrella body would be required in terms of the FCA for accredited organizations, the collectors' associations across the country were encouraged to form what is now currently NARCSA, so there is one point of contact between collectors and their stakeholders in this country, and that is NARCSA. We have 13 member associations scattered across the country, and we have a total at this point in time of around about 2,149 members within those associations. And Madam Chair, I want to stress that that number has remained substantially unchanged over the past 12 years. We have had some questions as to it's very easy to become a collector. If you want to collect firearms, just become a collector, and off you go. It's completely untrue, and I think the figures speak for themselves. So what does NARCSA stand for? To promote the collection, research, study, restoration, preservation, and responsible recreational use of collectible arms, ammunition, and related artifacts. And Chair, within the related artifacts is what we're talking about here today, particularly things like edged weapons and other weapons as envisaged in the Heritage Resources Act. We believe in sound relationships with all stakeholders, of which members in this chamber are a key part, and the responsible and ethical behavior of our members. So just to put into perspective what collecting is all about, the bulk of historical firearms and the related artifacts are in fact in private collection, not in museums. We often get the question, well, these are museums, why have you got private collectors? We have private collectors because museums can't afford it, they don't have the space for it, and worldwide it's a phenomenon which we see is that collections of the things we're talking about here today are in fact in private hands. I also must emphasize, though, that we do have a really close relationship with museums, particularly when it comes to preservation, restoration, and helping them. What are we talking about? About 1,000 million. Is the current estimated value of artifacts in private collection across the country. So it's a substantial part of our national estate, and that is recognized also in the Heritage Resources Act. We have collections of international significance, and you will find firearms and swords ranging in value from 1,000 rand to 1 million rand. And this, as I've emphasized earlier, is recognized by SARA. So that's our emblem, and this is what we live by, NARCSA. Preserving our heritage at the top, responsible firearm ownership together, and we believe that those two go hand in hand in terms of everything we do. So the artifacts which are of concern in terms of the Dangerous Weapons Bill, I thought the easiest would be just to illustrate these briefly in terms of what I would call a tour of a typical collector's convention. And Madam Chair, maybe we need to include collectors in this definition of gatherings, because as you can see on the screen at the moment, this is a significant gathering. So we typically, once a year, we would have a couple of thousand people through the Datsang Museum of Military History, where we hold this particular one. It's extremely popular both nationally and internationally. Now, what are we talking about? If you go on to the next slide, some of the exhibits. That's a range of Mauser rifles from 1871 to 1945. The next slide, that is from one member. That is the whole hall taken up by a diorama of World War I Battle of the Somme. And in there you will find rifles, pistols, swords, bayonets, apart from all the militaria which you there see illustrated. The next one typically is, well, one of the most famous collections of cult revolvers which we have in this country. The next one, the Russian Front, and again, if you look in the cabinet, you will find a rifle, a bayonet, and some other bits and pieces. The next one, a collection of British P1907 bayonets. Now, maybe one would be tempted to think a bayonet is a bayonet, but the collectors, being collectors, would look at all the types and variations of what you can encompass, and just that's just the 1907 pattern. There are about half a dozen patterns just of British bayonets. Similarly, there's a whole collection of German bayonets also on display at the time. The next one shows muzzleloaders. These from the Middle and Far East, dating from about the middle 1700s, but irrespective of whether it's 1700 or not, it's a muzzleloader, and it could also be construed as a dangerous weapon. Pistols from the 1600s, from the establishment of this country through to the late 1800s, those things as well. And then on the next slide, these are particularly, I think, relevant to this discussion, some priceless Japanese swords and early percussion pistols and things that go with it. So this is the problem, is all of those things need to be taken to such an event and need to be transported back from such an event. Or you would take a collection of those from one collector to another collector for a collector's evening. And the question that we are wrestling with at the moment is, how do we explain to our SAPS colleagues coming back at 10 o'clock at night, what am I doing with a boot full of rifles, pistols, bayonets? Now, true, we will have collector's identification on us in many instances, but if it happens to be swords, as I think Willie highlighted, swords do not require a permit, they do not require a license, and how do I prove to the guy at the roadblock that these things are legitimate collector's items and I'm not on my way to create a problem? So the key issues which we wanted to then highlight in the dangerous weapons bill, there's three of them. The first regards the definition of a dangerous weapon. I tried very briefly to illustrate that we believe that a dangerous weapon, being an object other than a firearm, designed as a weapon and capable of producing death or seriously bodily harm. That was the wording we had when we submitted our presentation. Many artifacts are designed both as weapons and as tools. Now, where does the one start and the other stop? An axe may be regarded as a tool for chopping wood or as a weapon, particularly if it happens to be a variety such as a machete, a hatchet, or a tomahawk. Similarly, I defy anybody to distinguish between a Wilkinson ceremonial sword and a Wilkinson service sword. The only difference is the quality of the steel and whether it's sharpened or not. But at face value, and this is where our concern comes in with the superficial examination, I could be accused of having a ceremonial sword in my possession, that this is now in fact a dangerous weapon when it is not. So our first proposal really just focused around a tweaking of that definition, and that's what we have on the screen there at the moment, is that a dangerous weapon means any object other than a firearm designed or adapted for use as a weapon. So if I've taken an ordinary chopper and I've done some things to make it really deadly, then I've obviously done things to that chopper that's no longer a tool. I'm going to do something naughty with it, and it's capable of causing death or inflicting seriously bodily harm. The next issue concerns the definition of a replica firearm. And this is a particular concern to us. The Dangerous Weapons Bill, an imitation firearm means an imitation firearm as defined in Section 1 of the Firearms Control Act, and replica, and I've underlined it, has a corresponding meaning. In the FCA, if you go and read what that says, it says an imitation firearm means anything that has the appearance of a firearm but is not capable of operating as such and cannot, by superficial examination, be identified as an imitation. But replica now has two different meanings in terms of the two legislations. It's got one meaning in the Dangerous Weapons Bill, and it's got another meaning in the Firearms Control Act. In the Firearms Control Act, a replica is considered to be a modern, fully working, and licensable firearm, which is a copy of a historic firearm, and it's often bought where you cannot afford the original one. On the next slide, please. That 1873 Colt If I had to go and buy one, I would probably pay 120,000 rand for it if I was lucky, but I'd be unlikely to find one. So in many instances, collectors who do not have unlimited means, Chair, are forced to buy a replica, and this one is currently made by a well-known company in Europe. It's an exact copy of the original Colt, and it's a fully functional, fully firing, beautifully made firearm. So in the Firearms Control Act, that replica is a fully functioning firearm in the Dangerous Weapons Bill, and replica is considered to be an imitation. So we just feel that in terms of manageable legislation, this thing needs to be tidied up. Now, obviously, we can leave that to our legal colleagues behind me here. We will come up with an innovative solution, I'm sure. But the proposal from the NARCL side is it might be easier to tweak the Firearms Control Act, but that must happen at the same time as this bill is going to be introduced. Otherwise, we're going to have conflicting legislation. So the suggestion is that the most practical solution would be to change the definition and the wording in the Firearms Control Act to read reproductions rather than replicas, and leave replicas in the Dangerous Weapons Bill. But we need to cover that with some form of a directive or other mechanism at the time that this bill is introduced, so that we do not land up with technicalities which are going to turn around and bite us. Issue three, and the last one, Chair, and I'm nearly finished, is we believe that there are issues with the consistency, legality, and workability of Section 2 and the subsections 1 and 2. And yes, we have spoken about it, but please allow me just to recap again because I've got two highlights. Any person who is in possession of a dangerous weapon or firearm replica or imitation, under circumstances which may raise a reasonable suspicion, and Chair, we hear very loud and clear your view on that wording. And secondly, in determining whether a person intends to use the dangerous weapon, etc., etc., etc. The problem we have is we think that is still a little bit vague and doesn't necessarily present either the citizen or the law enforcer with a really clear statement of what is expected of him or her. Some sections 2.1 and 2.2, in our opinion, are inconsistent legally, in that subsection 1 seeks to criminalize a suspicion, while it carries on in subsection 2 and seeks to criminalize an intent. Now, what are you trying to criminalize, the suspicion or the intent? And we just need to bring those two together. And we do really feel, Chair, and we've taken advice on this, that the may raise suspicion does place, in our opinion, please, undue discretion in the hands of the law enforcer, and may be unconstitutional in terms of its application. So we have three proposals, Chair, and Willie alluded to these earlier. We believe that the most legally rigorous wording would be what we have included there in 2.1. Any person who is in possession of a dangerous weapon under circumstances that justify the reasonable and necessary inference that such person intends using such dangerous weapon for unlawful purpose. Now, Chair, all my lawyer friends, my prosecutor friends, and my judge friends tell me that that's perfectly understandable and makes very good sense in legal terms. But whether the person on the ground would understand that, I think, is a challenge. And our understanding of this legislation is that it must be readily understandable by the man in the street and the law enforcer has to enforce it. So as an alternative, we've got number two, which says that any person who's in possession of a dangerous weapon under circumstances that justify the reasonable conclusion that such person intends using such dangerous weapon is for an unlawful purpose is guilty of an offense. We believe that's more understandable, but it is less legally rigorous. And the last suggestion tries to combine the two, Chair, and that is that any person who in possession of a dangerous weapon under circumstances that justify a conclusion beyond reasonable doubt that such person intends using a dangerous weapon. And Chair, all we're trying to say is that if we are stopped in a roadblock, or it is a guy in the backyard in the middle of the night in the camouflage, is the policeman must just stop for a minute and say, can I with reasonable certainty say that I can conclude beyond reasonable doubt that this person was up to no good? And have I thought of all the reasons that enable me to make that decision? Not just to say, well, I don't like this, and you're going to spend the weekend in jail. We think it should just go a little bit further. All we're proposing, Chair, please, is that the law enforcer must have a moment to think, to say, in terms of if all the information at my disposal, irrespective of the time of night, irrespective of the circumstances, does it enable me to reach a conclusion beyond reasonable doubt that this person is up to no good? So, Chair, that's about it. In conclusion, all we'd like to say that we believe that this bill will make a significant contribution to the maintenance of law and order, and with attention to the issues we've raised, we believe that it will be workable and understandable, both to the guy in the street and the guys body enforcer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, I'm going to break for tea first, and then we come back for questions. It's 5 past 11. We are going to be back here 11:15, and then we start with questions. Thanks.
akhawunti yakho. Makayidiposite kule akhawunti yakho.
Can we continue, please? Taking questions, can I get an indication from questions from the side of the members, Honourable Ndlovu? You can ask your question.
Thank you, Jefferson. I just wanted to... that's the last slide, slide number 30, I think so, yes. On the second option. I just wanted to understand, if you say that may be easier to understand, you say the other one is most appropriate in legal terms, but the second one may be easier to understand. Are you referring to a person who will be asked to prove why he's there, or are you referring to an officer? Because there are two sides here. Whom are you referring to? And secondly, who should understand? Is it an officer or a person who is become a victim at the end of the day? Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Kulabona?
Thank you, Chair. With no offence intended to yourselves or the knife experts or the people who have firearms and things that are hundreds of years old and cost thousands, I could equally pick up a kitchen knife and kill any of you. I could pick up a ballpoint pen or take your necktie and strangle someone. But I think it's quite possible that we're becoming... too detailed in this issue, and I'm sure that as we're going through this, we'll simply say a weapon or an item with intent to do harm. An item can be a brick. It can be. It is not the intention of this legislation to have an impact on collectors, on gaming people, on people who do martial arts, none of that. The point is, if they're using anything with intent to cause harm, that's where it is. And I think, look, you're raising these issues. It's very important because it's so easy to become very focused on legislation, and you become so focused you miss the obvious. I mean, it actually can happen that there is an unintended consequence. But I really don't want people to leave these hearings going away with any thought that this is in any way like the original proposal, which banned everything under the sun, self-defense-wise. That's not the intention at all. And I really think we must understand that collectors are not targets, but I do also understand that you're at risk in transporting, and that's a whole other issue that needs to be looked at. But I don't see that your business is in any way going to be influenced or any impact is going to be felt by you by this legislation. I mean, we're going to try very hard, and I see everybody behind you there nodding heads. It's not the intention to in any way have an impact on your businesses, on the knife people, on the martial arts people, anyone. As I say, a kitchen knife then. We would have to license kitchen implements or briar tongs. That's not what we're out to do. So I really take on board the suggestions you've made, and I'm sure we'll look at them very carefully. But again, I think it's important for us to say over and over that there is no intention on the part of this committee to have businesses shut down and people put in the bizarre situation of suddenly declaring 200-year-old firearms to be something that is a threat to someone because it's hanging on a wall. That's not going to happen, and it's actually not in this proposal as it stands. Thank you.
The question there?
You're driving on the road. You meet a roadblock. And the personnel that are mending the roadblock, I was just wondering if they're acquainted or they've been trained to differentiate between the replicas or the real dangerous firearms. You come there, they found your boot full of these guns, and how sure will they, how can they be sure that these guns are legal to travel with? And whilst there, who do they check with that they can let you pass with those types of weapons at a roadblock? About the knives, I don't know if I can go to the knives, Jefferson. Past. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I also have a question. Your proposal in terms of dangerous weapon for me personally is problematic. I think we need to be aware of the fact that this legislation is a piece of legislation that actually tries to prevent crime from happening. It's a preventative piece of legislation. Now, your definition saying designed or adapted for use exclude a spade or pick or whatever else. It doesn't have to be designed to be used or adapted to be used as a weapon. In the same week as the horrible rape case in the Dalsdorp, there was another woman killed in raped and killed in the Western Cape, who was, after raping her, they axed her to death. Now, that weapon was never designed with the intention for it to be used as something that to kill people. So I tend to agree with members that we must be careful to be over simplifying the issue. The reality of the matter is that it's about the intention of the individual carrying the weapon, the arm, the spade, the kitchen knife, even the collector's firearm. It's about the intention. And that is why this committee also last week, when we had the presentation, said to SAPS, before we adopt this piece of legislation, we want to know what training are they putting in place for police officers to be able to understand this legislation and to actually implement this legislation. So I would just like to hear your comment on your own redrafted definition of a dangerous weapon. Any other questions? Can we go on? Okay, you can respond to the questions that was put to yourself, please.
Chair, thank you for that. If I can start at the end and work backwards, I think what we're trying to highlight here is, as been eloquently said by yourselves, is a brick, a spade, a pole, a broken bottle can be used as a dangerous weapon. But the mere possession of a spade in the boot does not necessarily imply that you are going to commit a crime. That would be governed by the intent. I think the point we're trying to make here by saying it's designed or adapted for use is a kitchen knife by itself is probably an ambiguous item. A kitchen knife which has been carefully sharpened and shaped on the end and the handle has been trimmed. And, Chair, I've done the inspections in the SAP stores, so that's why I know about it. I don't carry them. then that has clearly been adapted for use as a weapon. A screwdriver in its standard form, which I walk out of the hardware store, possession of that in its standard form is probably innocuous. However, many of us are aware that a screwdriver which has been sharpened so that the hilt looks the same but the point is quite deadly, that has clearly been adapted for use as a weapon. So I'm thinking it would be more powerful from an enforcement point of view if we were to introduce this element, so you're not only reliant on the intent, you are in fact able to distinguish between adapted for use. So if I'm carrying around an ordinary screwdriver, I could be on my way to fix a plug. If I'm carrying around a screwdriver which has been sharpened to a point, or a pair of scissors, or a kitchen knife which has been remodeled, that is no longer just a pure kitchen knife, I'm clearly guilty of something really funny. And the law enforcer has a more powerful tool which they're able to deploy in terms of saying to this guy, now you've really got to convince me that you don't have an intent. I think that's the point we're trying to make, is to make it stronger, not more problematic. In terms of the training at a roadblock, I think, Chair, the point that we're trying to make throughout our presentation is that the officer at the roadblock must be trained and must go the extra mile in terms of applying his or her mind, and not because we are concerned that just the suspicion can take me to jail on a Friday night with no hope of finding my lawyer. What we're trying to say here is if the suspicion beyond reasonable doubt is that that officer has thought through all the things that he or she has been trained in to determine. And Chair, what I'm asking for, pleading for, is that the officer must by law be obliged to listen to my story. In other words, I must have an opportunity to explain where I've come from. Maybe make a phone call, get somebody to substantiate it, get somebody to come along and say, yes, here's proof there was an event today. Get somebody to come along and say, yes, I do belong to such and such an association. Chair, I have an agreement with my designated firearms officer that they can phone me day or night if any one of our members is caught in an affected situation, is to say, is this one of your members, or what's happening here? So there are ways and means, we believe, that the officer in the roadblock can call upon additional means to verify, and the member concerned who is affected by the roadblock should also be given the same opportunity to say, don't just cart me off to jail, give me a chance to please explain. Now, however we do that, I think there are many ways and means. We have suggested a way, but our concern is, please give us the chance to please explain. The issue around the wording of the proposal and the whether, in fact, the wording reasonable and necessary inference is for the enforcer or the enforcee. Honourable Member, Chair, through you, the answer was both. What we did is we took this legal wording and we ran it past a few, if I can call it, people, a man or woman in the street. Do you understand what this means without being told? And the count was 7 out of 10, no, we don't know what this means. We ran it past a couple of cooperative police officers and said, do you know what this means? And the answer was 5 out of 10, no, we don't know what it means. So our conclusion from that was, both from the enforcer point of view as well as from the person, the victim, if I can call it that, of the roadblock, was that that legislation without training was not perfectly clear. And therefore, the suggestion was to move to simpler wording, which would achieve the same purpose, but is in plain English. Because then we repeated the same test, and we said, right, now if we say to you, reasonable conclusion or conclusion beyond reasonable doubt, what does this mean to you? The answer was 10 out of 10 in both cases, yes, we understand that. So, Chair, that is where it came from. Okay.
Just ask you the last question. Reasonable doubt lies with the courts. The final, it's not with the police. And how does this impact on that?
Chair, we thoroughly agree. And I think, you know, it was for purposes of illustration, as reasonable doubt to him or herself. If we can find another word which conveys the same sense, is to say, because we were told the same thing, that is traditional court wording, And we can't make the policeman, the judge, the jury, and the executioner. But we need wording which will effectively say to the officer on the street, have you thought of all the consequences and all the factors that you are able to in your given situation that time of day or night? That's the comfort which we're looking for. That just the suspicion, I think you're a bad guy, off to jail, is no, have I thought all of this through? And the legislation tells me I must think through a checklist to say, have I thought of all of this? And having thought through all of this, yes, I'm still going to take you to jail.
Honourable Ndlovu, I'm making that the last question.
My understanding, Chairperson, do I understand that you mean, therefore, the person who is a victim here should understand what the police are saying to him or her at that time? What about if he or she does not understand that? Therefore, he goes to jail for a weekend or so. What will happen then? Because that's the underlying factor that we wanted to. If you wanted to make it clear to a person, it must be both sides, the officer and the person who has been arrested.
Chair, 100% agree, and I think this is what the point we're trying to get across, is that if I'm stopped in a roadblock, I should be able, in the absence of anybody else to defend me, to quote my rights, is to say to the policeman, please give me 5 or 10 minutes to explain in detail what is going on here, and if necessary, to make a corroborative phone call or to give you additional information so that you can make an informed decision, because it's my right to insist that you must give me an opportunity to make an informed decision. And at the same time, the policeman must also know that he can't just cart off that person on a suspicion. He must have gone through his checklist. And that is the comfort which we're looking for.
Won't you agree that Section 2, A to E is doing exactly that?
The checklist is indicative but not conclusive, Chair. And I think if one can embroider that checklist, and we have comfort that that checklist has gone through, then yes, it would achieve the intended purpose. But the key point we're trying to make without describing how is that the policeman or woman must have applied his or her mind. Thank you, Chair.
Very much for your presentation and for the time that you took to come here. We will take in consideration, as we would with every other presentation, the points that you've made when we start out our deliberations. The next presenters is the Cape Bar Council, so if I can call them to come and sit here at the presenter's desk. Can I ask you to introduce yourself and then immediately start with your presentation? I'm going to keep strict to time, please.
Thank you. I'm Advocate Pete Nihalik from the Cape Bar. With regards to the legislation itself, we believe that the teleological purpose is sound. It comes from a historical background where there was discrimination between the previous states. In other words, Transkei and other areas, you would be punished more for carrying a dangerous weapon, which is clearly unconstitutional. As lawyers, the first thing we look at is to see whether the Act actually passes constitutional muster. In this regard, we look specifically at Section 12 of the Constitution, which says that freedom and security of the person, everyone has the right to freedom and security of the person, which includes the right to be free from all forms of violence, either public or private sources. Therefore, quite clearly, the police have a positive duty to enforce this right. So, too, there is the right of assembly, demonstration, and to picket and to petition. More specifically, Section 17 of our Constitution, everyone has the right to peacefully and, we emphasize, unarmed to assemble, to demonstrate, to picket, and to present petitions. Political rights is also included. That's section 19. Every citizen is free to make political choices, which includes the right to participate in activities or to recruit members for a political party, to campaign for a political cause. Then we have the limitation of rights. Now, the limitation of rights, which is set out in section 36, we all understand that for every right there are certain limitations as soon as it impacts on the greater good of society. What we believe is positive about this piece of legislation, and we like the wide definition, by the way, as opposed to the other learned speakers who spoke before. In fact, we promote the fact that this definition should be extremely wide, because a lighter could be considered a dangerous weapon if you intend to burn down a house. Hence, you cannot restrict it and then create certain loopholes for persons to say, well, it doesn't fall within the ambit of this definition. Most importantly, we say, is the circumstances which are set out in section 2, which demonstrates when a reasonable suspicion can be created. And bearing in mind that this is an objective test. In other words, it's not the subjective say-so of a police officer who has a predisposition to arrest persons. It is an objective test based on accumulative factors which will ultimately determine, and it will be determined by the court, as to whether that suspicion is reasonable. Bearing in mind there are checks and balances. The one concern that was raised earlier was the issue regarding what happens if you are stopped. We should include in this legislation the issue that you should have a right to explain yourself. We don't need it in this legislation. It's already provided for in the Constitution. Section 35 of our Constitution says that everyone has the right to adequate legal representation and to explain himself. So our Constitution, in terms of Section 2, is the supreme law of the country. Hence, there's no need to over-regulate this at all. In fact, every person has the right to explain himself. What may become problematic is if you include a provision that says he must explain himself when caught under those circumstances, or she must, because that violates the right to remain silent. And then again, you enter perilous waters where any legislation that goes against that could violate the right to remain silent. One aspect that we feel could be added in terms of the collective issues that may be decided is that we have similar provisions in the Criminal Procedure Act where the court looks at certain factors to determine whether individuals should be released on bail. And the last clause is any other factor which the court may consider. And although the wording does provide for it on top, we believe that one could add right at the end any other factor, because we cannot possibly contemplate the factual matrix of each and every case. Hence, it may just assist the court in giving them a wider discretion so that their discretion is not limited by legislation. I've got 4 minutes, and let me deal with the last aspect. The last aspect is that we already have all the legislation in place that covers this act. Hypothetically, the charge of assault. Any person who carries any weapon, it doesn't have to be a weapon, a stone, any instrument in his hand, her hand, and acts in a manner that threatens the other individual, which causes the other individual to feel fear, that individual can be arrested for assault. If you walk into a place with a baloney in your pocket and you say, I have a bomb in my pocket and I intend to blow up the establishment, you can be equally arrested for that. You don't actually have to have that. Then we have the Intimidation Act, which has similar provisions. So we already have legislation in place. However, what we do like about this, you will see in terms of the Gatherings Act, which we've included in our memorandum, the Gatherings Act doesn't specifically refer to firearms. And that provides for 15 or more people as per the definition. This particular act almost creates an easy, comfortable need to look at a situation, identify the danger, assess all the objective factors, and then to apply a discretion. Vitally important is, of course, the training in this regard, that the members do not willy-nilly arrest, but that they can actually see that there's a series of steps that they have to analyze, even though it's a quick analysis, to determine whether there are sufficient objective facts to do this. And lastly, we comment that, importantly, historically, unfortunately, there have been some pieces of legislation that have been introduced for a good purpose and then have been undermined, their legitimacy have been undermined, that this law must be applied uniformly and it must not be applied arbitrarily. It should not be applied in situations where there are different interests at stake. It must just be applied to defend and protect the citizens of the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Members open for questions. Seems like it's been quite clear. Members understand everything. Is the department anything from your side? Happy? Thank you very much.
You.
I then call on South African Wing Shooters Association. Oh, yeah.
And I'm the CEO of the SA Wing Shooters Association. Taking into consideration what the Honourable Chair has already mentioned with regards to the intent of the Act, I'm going to make my presentation very short. Just a quick background, South African Wing Shooters Association is a police-registered and accredited hunting association. We're a registered non-profit organisation and a registered public benefit organisation. Wing shooting or game bird shooting is a group activity and traditionally a group activity and is hardly ever practiced individually. In South Africa, wing shooting is a 400 million rand per annum industry. In short, wing shooting is an activity where a group of hunters, sometimes as many as 30 to 50 individuals, hunt proclaimed game birds in flight during the specified hunting season using purpose-built shotguns, and it may or may not include the use of traditional gun dogs. Wing shooting is a multicultural, non-religious pastime and includes the entire family and is open to anybody who wishes to participate. Okay, our main concern is obviously section 2.2E, which relates to the relevant factors which must be followed and taken into account when considering individual behavior, specifically point E. And our proposal for that is, because we aren't in groups, we also sometimes gather on public premises, like next to the side of a road on our way to a shoot, because we have people coming from various cities or various towns to join the same hunt. We sometimes wait for them on public, next to public roads. So we would like to ask the portfolio committee to please amend the section 2.2E by adding a section that would exclude legal hunting of any sort, including wing shooting and bird shooting, from the factors that needs to be taken into account by the officer at that stage. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I think we did indicate already that we are going to do exactly that. It already makes provision for cultural activities, etc. And we also did indicate last week already that we would like to include sporting activities in that. So it will fall under that. Thank you very much for your presentation. Members, any questions? Nothing?
Did we say that E in particular would be revised, because it certainly is an issue in relation to gaming, that 2E.
It is not necessarily at E where it will be revised. It will be where it deals with the exclusions, the cultural activities, etc., which then would take care of E subsequently as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I call on the next presentation, Mr. Martin Wood and Associates? Can we just switch off, Nicolette, that microphone there, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The problem about going last is that everybody has said what you want to say before you.
Were you not lost?
Am I not lost? Very briefly, I'm here to represent the Security Industry Alliance. That's an industry body that represents most of the large security organizations, registered security organizations in the country. It encompasses about 450,000 registered security service providers and employees. The Blade Tool and Sporting Goods Forum was formed when the first draft of the Dangerous Weapons Bill was introduced in 2010. In response to the need to have a body of people, importers, retailers, etc., who would represent the interests of people that buy, use and sell airsoft objects, knives and related paraphernalia. The South African Gun Owners Association, which should be well known to the Portfolio Committee, represents legal gun owners in general and has many thousands of members. I start my presentation with the heading General Comments, and I say that the legislation is potentially extremely problematic. Before that is interpreted as being a negative comment, I want to stress that this bill is a vast improvement on the previous proposals, and SAPS, and I can be quoted on this, SAPS must be congratulated for the effort that they put into the revised draft, because it is a lot more sensible. I think it is, with proper training, implementable, but subject to some of the comments that I want to make now. It is problematic in the sense that it focuses on conduct and circumstances, and that gives rise inevitably to the need by a law enforcement official to exercise some form of discretion. And discretions are problematic without guidelines and without training. And I do make the point that there needs to be policy guidelines in place, and that would tie up quite neatly with the need to have proper training in place. I, unfortunately, had the recent experience of being told by police officers that I had no constitutional rights when I was arrested. So it demonstrates that there is a need for police officers to be trained, particularly on Section 35 of the Constitution, as mentioned by my colleague from the Cape Bar Council. If we look at the next slide, definition of a dangerous weapon, quite surprisingly, my organizations want the definition to be expanded. We say it's too restrictive because, as has been mentioned by the learned member, Cola Barnard, a brick or a rock is also a dangerous weapon in a certain set of circumstances. So we don't want it to be limited to a firearm or a weapon that was designed or intended to be used as a weapon. We want it to cover anything where it is intended to be used as a weapon. And I think that the consensus from the presentations as well as the comments that has been made earlier is that that indeed would be what needs to be done. And I'd just like to stress that we support the fact that you need to state that the weapon or object is intended to be used as a weapon and which is capable of producing death or serious bodily harm. I think that's pretty straightforward. It's easy to understand, and I don't think the public or a law enforcement official would have any difficulty with that. I'm not going to talk about imitation firearms or replica firearms. That's been dealt with by the Collectors Association. Other than to say that there is a need to amend the Firearms Control Act. It's been a problem that's been raised over a number of years. Imitation firearms, prohibited firearms, deactivated firearms, all of those definitions need to be revisited, and I hope my colleagues from SAFS are nodding their heads. They understand the need for that, so I'm not going to dwell on that. The next slide is headed at paragraph 2 of the proposals. We understand that SAFS does need to have discretions and that they do need to look at the circumstances and when they stop somebody and say, what are you doing, why are you here, why have you got these objects on you. The problem is that we have to eliminate subjectivity. We have to make any assessment of any situation objective. That is extremely difficult for a number of reasons. Policemen have different experiences, they have different interpretations of the law, they have different approaches to any given situation. And it's critical that any situation be approached by the same police officer, by any police officer in the same situation, in the same way. That's why you need policy and you need guidelines. I made the point at the bottom that Section 2 creates an implied presumption of guilt, and we would like to see the definitions changed with the elimination of may give rise to a suspicion, to change it to say does give rise to a reasonable suspicion. Now, there's been a lot of debate about what's a reasonable suspicion and how do you exercise your mind to come to that decision. I like the word does because it implies that the person who's in that situation has to think more carefully about that situation. And that was the point that Mr. Webb from the Collectors Association made. We want the policeman to apply their mind to the situation properly to come to the correct conclusion. And I make the point that when you substitute does with the word may, it requires a greater degree of consideration. All we want is that all of the relevant and reasonable circumstances be taken into account before the police officer decides that he needs to then invoke the provisions of the Act and then perhaps arrest the person who they are involved with. Then I make some suggestions that may be or may seem a little contentious, but I think the learned chair lady made the point earlier, we want to use this legislation to prevent crime. In other words, it's not here to prosecute people once they've committed an act. We want to use the legislation to prevent the commission of acts. And I've made some suggestions which I think would guide the police in how to apply the Act. I've suggested you can't have any type of weapon at any illegal gathering because many gatherings require, for example, municipal permission if you want to do it within a municipal area. If it's not an authorized gathering, then the police should be entitled to go and they should investigate and they should remove any type of weapon in the possession of the people at that gathering. And then I suggest further that any gathering, protest action in a public place, employers' premises, municipal or government buildings, that would take into account, for example, service delivery protests, where we've unfortunately seen some quite extensive violence and property damage as a result of these types of protests. I've said in a public march, there's an in missing there, march in public. In a protest action on private property where the landowner or the legal occupier does not want any form of dangerous weapons. And then perhaps the most contentious during any organized union or labor activity or protest. The reason why I put that in is because Section 17 of the Constitution, as raised by my learned colleague from the Cape Bar, says that any protest, any gathering should take place unarmed. And we unfortunately do have difficulties in this country when we have large gatherings where there's protests. The reason for the protest could be quite legitimate, but there seems to be a tendency towards violence, And in those instances, many dangerous weapons are apparent. They're apparent from newsreel, from film clips, and we need to give serious consideration to how to limit those situations to avoid the potential for violence. Then, again, I think I didn't get the full text of what General Jakob said about the exemptions, but it seems that SAPs are going to provide exemption mechanisms for legitimate employment activities, legitimate cultural activities, which would cover the points that I've raised in my next slide, and that is that there must be provision for the security industry, because most often you'll find security officers at places where there is some form of protest protecting property or protecting citizens, and many of those officers do carry firearms, and if they're not carrying firearms, they might be carrying a baton or they might be carrying a pepper spray. So they need to be exempted if they're carrying out their legitimate contractual employment activities. And I've indicated that the provisions of the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority and legislation need to be taken into account, as well as the provisions of Regulation 21 of the Firearms Control Act, because they provide the recipe to enable a security officer to take a firearm or other paraphernalia on duty with them. I've indicated that we object to the amendment to the Regulation of Gatherings Act. That objection does not stand in the light of what General Jakobs has said, because they're going to make provision for cultural, sporting, hunting and other types of activities that has already been spoken about before me. Then one further point that nobody else seems to have picked up on, and that is there's an interpretation section at the back of the bill which gives the rationale for the proposals. And I've drawn this to SAPS's attention, and I hope that they will amend it, because it is misleading. And what might happen is when a prosecution is underway and a judge or a magistrate is trying to find out what the purpose of the legislation is, if you look at the back, it says the objects of the bill. And the objects are stated to be the bill therefore seeks to repeal all existing legislation regulating dangerous weapons in the Republic and to provide for uniform legislation. No problem. The bill furthermore seeks to prohibit the possession of dangerous weapons, firearms, or replicas or imitation firearms in public. Now that's clearly wrong, because it is legal to carry a firearm in public. As long as you have a license for that firearm, as long as you comply with the provisions of the Firearms Control Act, it has to be concealed, it has to be in a holster, etc., then you can carry a firearm in public. So I would like SAPS to remove this, please, so as to avoid misunderstanding. Because a police officer, if he has the bill or has the act when it eventually is finalized, if he sees this and reads this, he's then going to stop somebody and say, you're carrying a firearm in public. The legislation says that you can't. The intent and purpose of the legislation is that you cannot carry a firearm in public. Now that's clearly wrong, so I would like that to be corrected if it's possible, please. I just make the note that it should be please amended if it's possible. And then suggestions on clause 3.3, provision must be made for historical enactments, film productions. Now nobody seems to have mentioned film productions, but the Western Cape has a large industry where due to the weather and other considerations, many films are made. And unfortunately or fortunately, films these days have a need and a use for deactivated firearms or for firearms that are designed or converted for theatrical purposes. They normally fire blank ammunition. Now, we don't want a situation where a film producer is carrying a substantial number of deactivated or replica firearms to or from a film shoot, and they're arrested because they have a boot full of what is perceived to be weapons. So there has to be an exemption that would include film and theatrical productions as well, Madam Chair. And then I've given a brief summary. I don't want to go through that. And a very big thank you for listening to us.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hoots. I'm going to turn it around this time. I want the department to respond first, especially around the back the memorandum. I think it's a valid point. Can we just get your comment, but also around any other issues? Then I want to give hand over to members for questions. The reason I'm doing it is maybe your answers will limit some questions as well.
Chief, just before responding to the back and the objective memorandums, I think the definition that is being provided by Mr. Hood is something we would want to, when you asked us to relook at the definition, it's something that we would like to look at in that redefinition. In terms of the memorandum objective, I think that was a technical slip-up, and we need to amend that. There's no question about it. I think it was because we were dealing with so many different versions that fell in, but there's no question that we would need to amend that, because I think that point is absolutely valid. I think the Portfolio Committee asked us to look at the implementation plan for this legislation. I think Sir Hood's comments about the training, et cetera, have got to be part of that implementation plan, which we asked to present to you before the bill is finally adopted. And then just the final comment on, I think, some of the issues that General Jacobs read out at the beginning of the meeting would address even the film industry and all the queries that Mr. Hood has said about the security industry, the sports section, even the film industry. It's broad enough to cover that, Chair. And if you're okay.
General Jacobs?
Chair, no thanks. I think I've been covered by what the Secretary has said. Thanks.
Members, can I hear, after the response there, is there any questions? Ms. Kulabana, Mr. Legeto?
I just had a problem with the section under general comments of the presentation. Where you're saying the focus must be on the dangerous object and not the intention. Now, we're back to the kitchen knife. My intention is either to chop an onion or slit your throat. The intention is everything, not the dangerous weapon or the item which could be or because of the intention become a dangerous weapon. So I had a problem with that one. That section seemed to me to actually be a reversal of what you argue later. Excuse me, you're probably like some advocate, brilliant person, but I'm blonde. I think we have already, and obviously you weren't there, but we did discuss the business of traditional weapons, but in context, at a wedding where it is the tradition to display traditional weapons, that is a gathering, but it is not a political march, rally, protest, etc., where in fact that weapon becomes a dangerous weapon. So again, it's context, which will be, I'm quite sure, very carefully laid out. I don't know that we can go to the extent of saying exempt filmmakers, exempt, you know, exempt theatre people, because you're going to leave somebody out if you start detailing it like that. But they will, I'm quite sure the way we're working it will be a blanket exemption. And again, you have to go back every time to the intent. If it's for a criminal purpose, it's out, and that's it. That is the defining definition, as I see it.
I just want to clarify the second question from the presenter himself, in saying that carrying a firearm in public is legal. Did I hear you clearly?
Yes,
I think so. But, you know, that is still fear in many people, including myself, except to say the firearm is in the boot or in the safe. I'm not sure whether that's what the regulation says, that you can yield, that is carrying. But when the firearm is locked in a boot somewhere, it's not in public.
Mr. Legeto, I'm going to call you to order. The legislation does make provision for people to carry firearms, legally owned firearms, in a prescribed manner, which means it must be in a holster, etc., etc. So it is it is correct. So it is absolutely correct, and we're not dealing with that legislation at the moment. The reason why Mr. Woods raised that point was to emphasize the fact that the memorandum as it is not correct. So that is what we're trying to address. Thank you. You can respond to Ms. Kulabonat's question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're quite correct. It does appear to be contradictory, but it's not intended to be, if you'll excuse the pun, contradictory. We wanted a broadened definition of a dangerous weapon, so it would include something that is not immediately apparently a dangerous weapon. And at the same time, yes, you have to focus on the intent of the person who's in possession of it and what they want to do. So your comments are absolutely correct.
Can I just ask you, while we have you here, do you believe that Section 2 deals adequately with the means test in terms of asking the test that the police officer should be going through in terms of whether the person is carrying the dangerous weapon and the legal circumstances or not?
No. I don't think that you can put enough in legislation to empower a police officer to do a specific job that the legislation requires. It's a far broader need in terms of training and policy guidelines. Mr. Webb, for example, made the point, let the police officer know that I have a right to explain myself, my conduct, my possession of a dangerous object. That is not limited to the Dangerous Weapons Act. It's a right. So the police officers need that foundation.
Members, thank you very much. Ms. Hoots, thank you for your presentation. I think we do take your point. We've already heard from the department that they prefer some of the definitions that you did propose as well. The committee will discuss and finally take the decision on that when we start deliberating. I think members, and also to the public who are here, that is why it was very important for this committee as well last week to indicate to SAPS that we will not pass this legislation before we have a detailed implementation plan which includes the training that should be done on this. Because they brought this piece of legislation to us without costing it, saying that there's no cost involved. Now, you can't train without cost, so there's got to be cost involved. So I give you the assurance from the committee that we will not pass this legislation before we have seen that implementation plan, including the training and the costing of that. The next presenter is the Catholic Bishops' Conference, the Parliamentary Liaison Officer. Can I ask you, sir, just to move a bit forward so that we can see you, if you don't mind sitting here in any of the open chairs next to committee researcher.
Thank you, Chairperson. As you will have seen from our written submission, we didn't specifically want to make an oral submission to you and take up your time because we have so little to say about it. But let me just say, by way of background, for some of your members who may not have been here when the last time we made a presentation to your portfolio committee, quite a few years ago, that the Catholic Church maintains a full-time parliamentary liaison office just over the road here, and we've been making submissions to portfolio committee since 1996 on a huge range of legislation and policy issues. And we do that not because we are in any way experts in what lies before you today, or indeed in most of the legislative matters that come before Parliament, but rather because the Church, as with most faith groups, is concerned for the wider good of society, the common good of society. And just about every piece of legislation has an impact on the wider good. So if we have anything sensible to say, then we do like to come along and make that little contribution. In this particular case, as is stated in the preamble and in the memorandum to the bill, violent crime is obviously a scourge in this country. It's been bemoaned for decades. Anything that can have a positive impact on that is to be welcomed. We believe that this piece of legislation can have a positive impact, and therefore we want to support it in general terms. In our submission, we've raised two queries. The first one you've already been dealing with in some detail, and that relates to Clause 2E. The mere fact that a number of people are carrying a dangerous weapon, in our view, should not be indicative that each and every one of them then has some sort of negative or malicious intent. And I've heard now since I came in earlier that this clause is going to be addressed, and as I understand it, by way of exceptions. I would simply say that I think that's a tricky way of doing it, because you start accepting cultural activities and religious activities and sporting activities, and then in 3 years' time somebody comes up with another form of activity that was not anticipated, and then you have to amend to include that kind of activity. So that's one. The exception route is a tricky one, because we cannot foresee all the possibilities in the future. The other reason why it's tricky is that, unfortunately, what may start off as a very innocent cultural activity can turn into something different. We've seen this happening. What may start off as a religious gathering can turn into something nasty, and the next thing is violence breaks out. As one of the members said earlier, it is all to do with intention. And I would suggest, with respect, that rather than going the uncertain route of exceptions, that if 2E was simply amended to indicate that if the other members of a gathering were themselves behaving in a threatening or intimidatory way, in other words, to bring in some of the wording from Clause 2B or 2C and add that into 2E, then you would solve the problem pretty much. In other words, an intimidatory or threatening crowd, and you're a member of that crowd and you're carrying such a weapon, that's a strong indicator that you had some sort of malicious intent. So it's neither the size of the crowd nor the nature of their business that is indicative, but rather the nature of their intent. That is our one suggestion. Our other suggestion is simply that we were unable to understand why it was deemed unnecessary to place this piece of legislation before the House of Traditional Leaders, given that so many of these activities, cultural activities and so on, which do involve the use of dangerous or potentially dangerous weapons, take place as part of cultural ritual. Surely our traditional leaders should have the opportunity to deliberate on this, and other than coming to this forum to make suggestions, should be able to give us a rather more formal input into the process. In other words, in our view, this is par excellence a piece of legislation which has an impact on customary activity and traditional activities, and therefore the leaders of those communities should have an opportunity to consider it. Those are our submissions, Chair Lady.
Thank you very much. Members' questions? Honourable Mclovel.
Chairperson, I just want to ask the presenter, how do you judge the behavior of an intimidator? Because I can be very intimidator if I want to, but I'm a gentleman and I'm a very nice man.
A matter of
but how do you judge that? You know, I'm asking this question because you because in your presentation, page 2, you said all possession dangerous weapon gathered together, but rather than some, and all of them behave in an intimidatory, threatening or otherwise unlawful manner. Now, I'm trying to say, how do you judge that? How do you expect the police personnel to judge me on that one? Because it will be really discriminating against myself. And secondly, Chairperson, if you say it should be referred to the traditional house of National House of Traditional Leaders, are you implying that it's only rituals and cultural events that this bill is dealing with, on the exception that should be dealt with by that house, or are you saying the whole bill should be referred there?
Yeah, this has opened a whole another area for me, in that we did blithely say at cultural events, and I've also said it, traditionally one would use such, display such weapons. However, I did not consider that in fact there are apparently instances where those weapons end up being used for violent acts. Now, by allowing displays of that sort, then one is automatically allowing the possibility that they will actually be used, could be used, after consumption of alcohol or whatever, for violent purposes. I think it's actually something that's going to need a lot more investigation and interrogation, without just blithely saying, allow them, allow them, allow them, because of this reason or that reason or the next reason. I think that it's going to need quite careful consideration. I have no idea, and perhaps we can do research on it, if it is a widespread problem, if it is a problem at all. I'm just taking your word for it, but I should, because of who you represent, I presume. So, you know, we need to do the research on that, because I don't know if that is a huge problem or if it's an isolated incident of criminality. It's an isolated incident. If it's in fact a recurring problem, we're actually creating an even greater problem by allowing it.
Members, I want to caution members to be very careful in what we are raising, because, I mean, let's take the point that has been made. There's a constitutional right for people to be involved in their cultural activities. This is not the work of this committee and of the intention of this bill to infringe on that right. In the same argument can then be made that the Airsoft Club, after having the sporting event, is having a few beers, and afterwards they use the weapons for the wrong reason. So I want us to be very cautious about what we are saying here. The Gatherings Act deals with that in detail. And it deals with permission that has to be for permission for the gathering to take place, which includes these events that we are talking about. So I really, really would caution members here that we do not fall in a trap here, that it's not the intention of this bill. I am going to allow you to respond to these questions. Let me rather keep quiet on this issue, because I think we are really treading on very, very thin ice, and it can end up being embarrassing. But before you respond, I would like the department to respond, and I would like you to respond specifically to the issues that were raised. Thanks.
Chair, I mean, I think we share your point.
Sorry, Secretary, also specifically on the reference to the legislation should be going to the House, National House of Traditional Leaders.
Chair, I think we share your point about the issue of regulating cultural gatherings and the constitutional aspects. I think that in the same way as if a wind shooter got drunk and after a wind shooting event, and then the circumstances and the intention of carrying that weapon would change. So the same applies to a cultural gathering. That if a cultural gathering, people got drunk and then somebody decided to use that weapon for domestic violence or any other purpose, then the Act makes very clear provision that the intention would change. That it's no longer the intention for it to be used for a cultural gathering. The intention is then for it to be used for a criminal purpose, and the Act makes it clear. I think that if we start dealing with cultural gatherings, etc., we're going to find ourselves in a problem in terms of the Constitution. So I think the way we need to look at that is where that changes, the intention changes. And the Act is very, and particularly if we take the wording that we were talking about earlier with regard to what Mr. Hood was saying, that its intention would cover those sorts of events. Given that we were not regulating for cultural purposes, it wasn't necessary, but I'll ask the state law advisors, because they were the ones who recommended to us about the cultural, about the House of Traditional Leaders. So I'll ask them to just respond to that.
State law advisors?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, indeed, we have recommended on the objects memo under paragraph 6, parliamentary procedure. We have recommended that the bill, that is not necessary to refer the bill to the National House of Traditional Leaders in terms of Section 18.1A of the Traditional Leaders and Governance Framework Act 2003, since it does not contain provisions pertaining to customary law or customs of traditional communities. That was basically the reason why we recommended that the bill is not necessary to be referred to the National House. And now, Chairperson, if you look at the provisions of the bill, in order for it to be referred to the National House, it must contain the provisions which pertain to the customs of traditional leaders or to customary law. We've looked at the provisions of the bill, all of them, and we could not find any provision which actually deal or pertain to the customs. If you look at the bill as a whole, you read it as a whole, there was nothing that suggests that it deals with the custom. The only provision that could relate to that was on clause 4, amendment to Regulation of Gatherings Act. That was where the wording cultural or religious purpose was used. And it was used as an exception from falling within the categories of the bill. So in essence, Chairperson, we could say the bill doesn't relate to that. The core of the bill doesn't regulate that. It regulates the possession of dangerous weapons in general. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much for that clarity. Do you want to respond? Sorry, there's still one more thing from the department. General Jacobs.
Thank you, Chair. Just regarding the exceptions, the examples that we've mentioned to the committee actually comes from Australian legislation, and I think it has been the experience in other countries that you may have to make certain exceptions, like for the security industry, etc. Thank you, Chair.
You can respond if there's anything you want to.
Thank you. The first point is around what is intimidation. We have an Intimidation Act which contains a definition which I can't quote to you offhand, but it is there already on the statute book. And I think the essence of it is that the person making the initial judgment, the police officer called to a scene where someone is complaining of being intimidated by somebody else, has to assess the nature of the act. Is the victim someone who is in a position of weakness vis-a-vis the person who is supposedly intimidating them? There's a whole bunch of criteria that come into the argument, and the police officer is called upon to make a discretionary judgment there and then. Later on, if it gets to court, then again the argument can go back and forth, and there's a lot of case law dealing with what constitutes intimidation. I think in a piece of legislation like this, you want to make it as easy as possible for the police officer who has to intervene to understand what his or her rights are and what the criteria are that he or she must bring to bear. How you put that into legislative wording that covers each and every possible situation, well, I don't think that you can do that. But I think it's possible to use the word intimidation or threatening behavior in a way that we all understand. If you are clearly showing somebody your antique muzzle-loading firearm at a gathering of enthusiasts, you're not intimidating anyone. If you're standing outside there on the street corner waving a revolver in the air and carrying on and shouting and screaming and swearing at people, you probably are intimidating. And I know that's also covered by other legislation. Chairperson, I'm not going to get into a long debate about the wisdom of going the exclusion route or not. I think I've made the point. If you have one person who is innocently carrying a dangerous weapon, you can have 100 people who are innocently carrying dangerous weapons. It's not the number that's important, it's their intention. And I hear what the state law advisors say about the House of Traditional Leaders. The fact remains that all over our country, at all times, for very legitimate reasons, people carry weapons that fall under the definition of dangerous weapons as part of their completely legitimate cultural activities. You can exclude that. Yes, you can. Is every police officer going to understand that exclusion? I'm not so sure. I think at least since we have a constitutional provision that allows, that gives us a House of Traditional Leaders, that they should be consulted on this. They should have the opportunity to deliberate on it and come up with some suggestions. If the committee thinks that's unnecessary, I guess the House of Traditional Leaders is quite capable of expressing their own views on the matter anyway. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I also just, I'm not opening the debate, but over and above the opinion of the state law advisors, Parliament itself also applies its mind through the Speaker's office and the legal, the tagging office of Parliament, where legislation should be going and what section of the Constitution legislation is. So it's not only the department and the state law advisors that determine that. It is also determined by those officers, and I presume that they did apply their mind. Mr. Van Onselen, are you here, sir? My apologies for skipping you. I don't know how I went through the agenda. You're the next person on, so can you please move forward? Can you please introduce yourself?
Good afternoon, or is it morning? My name is Gerard van Onselen, and Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the privilege to be here to address some of the concerns that I have with the bill. In starting my comments on this, I must say that many of my fears on this have been allayed at the moment. So please consider my comments from the perspective that I am somebody who is not schooled in the law per se. I'm more just concerned on some of the wording of the bill and some of the possible implications that it may have. When we think about the Dangerous Weapons Bill, from my understanding of South African law, we already have laws on the books that can punish somebody for a conspiracy to commit a crime, for example, a conspiracy to commit murder. I'm certain that something like public endangerment, whether you do it with your fist or a dangerous weapon, is already punishable. And also that if I were to brandish a weapon in public, for example, if I was waving a revolver around, that would give the police the right essentially to take me out, because I am endangering the public. So in saying that, we have to, I believe, evaluate this bill from the perspective that it may cause a covert infringement on the right of people to possess self-defense weapons. And the reason why I'm saying that is that I am concerned that somebody like my wife, who's been carrying a knife for quite some time, trained in self-defense, will be concerned not to carry a knife any longer out of a fear for unreasonable prosecution or wrongful prosecution. So in moving to my presentation, just quickly outlining the overview of my concerns, the first one is a reasonable suspicion really reason enough for a criminal conviction? Now at this point I have come to realize that reasonable suspicion is in certain degrees is reasonable. Am I correct on that? Also, is the bill, or will the bill perhaps ignore legitimate public carry of weapons? And I'm specifically referring to weapons carried in public. And will the bill provide for opportunity of covert infringement? And what I mean by that is that some South Africans that do carry weapons for self-defense, will they perhaps be fearful of carrying weapons after the bill is passed? And then would the bill have a negative effect on law enforcement? And will there be opportunities for corruption, victimization, and exploitation under this bill? And essentially, how will that be prevented? Now, in reading some of the media statements on the bill, what I saw was one of the reasons put forward in the media was that the bill is supposed to give us a uniformity of weapon laws and to prohibit dangerous weapons at public protests. And however, the proposed legislation, this was a statement by the Minister of Police, will not prohibit people from carrying licensed guns and pepper sprays. So my main concern is that the bill will essentially infringe on the right to take or to carry weapons for self-defense. Then also when we look at the wording of Clause 2.1 states the prohibition of possession of dangerous weapons, firearms, replicas, or imitation firearms. That's on the heading. And it seems to me very much like a blanket statement. I know that it is outlined further on and explained with the five specifiers, but I'm just concerned on the it almost seems like a blanket prohibition language being introduced here. So my main concern then, and a word on the intention of the bill, is that the permitted legal carry of weapons seems not to be clearly and adequately addressed. Maybe it is addressed in the language, in the legal language of the bill, but it is not communicated to the public clearly. If the intention of the bill is to control the carrying of weapons at protests, and like the Minister of Police said, should we not maybe say that a bit more clearly? And the intention is then, we are told, it is not to render the public defenseless. And to do so, I believe the bill would have to provide a clear distinction between legal and illegal carry of weapons. I do not wish to spend time on the reasonable suspicion because I feel I cannot really comment with sense on that. But in moving on, what is the crime under the bill? Is the crime under the bill the mere possession of a weapon, or is it the intention of the use of a weapon? And then I am wondering, Madam Chair, is it moral to convict someone only on a reasonable suspicion or on suspicion? I understand reasonable suspicion is a legal term, but what makes the intention of use of a weapon different from, let's say, having an intention to steal but not yet having stolen something? And then I'm asking, should it not rather be the conspiracy to commit a crime, if provable, beyond a reasonable doubt? For example, if somebody is planning to commit a murder, there's a lot of evidence that the state can have on the act or of planning to commit a murder, and that is prosecutable. And then looking at beyond a reasonable doubt, I'm wondering, how will the police and prosecutors prove beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody would have committed a crime? For example, I'm thinking of somebody perhaps in my yard with an airsoft gun or a replica firearm or something of that. It is likely that somebody may be carrying a toy like that essentially to brandish to keep other perpetrators away from him or her. So I'm just wondering at that point, how would we distinguish between them? So what my concern is that possession alone should not be made the crime, and I think we have established that. The intention is very important, and that there should be ample evidence to prove that somebody was in fact committing a crime, like public endangerment or something along those lines. So my concern is on the distinction. I think the distinction should be made between mere possession and using a weapon dangerously, for example, in public endangerment. Moving on quickly, I would think that if the crime is intimidation, then prosecute and punish intimidation. If the crime is public endangerment with weapons, then prosecute and punish public endangerment. If the crime is conspiracy to murder, then prosecute and punish the conspiracy to commit murder. If the crime is murder, then prosecute and punish murder. If the crime is brandishing weapons at public gatherings, then clarify that explicitly in the bill. I'm saying this because I believe we need the offence in terms, or the crime in terms of the bill, needs to be well defined. So as a private civilian, I would like to know exactly what is and is not the crime under this bill. And possession of a weapon alone cannot be deemed a crime. And like I said, I know most of those fears were allayed. Is it then not rather a question of the illegitimate use of weapons that we have to look at, and perhaps clarify that and make that strong in the bill that if you are perhaps brandishing a weapon, that is actually the crime instead of possession of the weapon? Then I must also add that not all South Africans carry weapons in public for crime. South Africans also carry weapons for self-defense and other legitimate reasons. We know there are very high violent crime rates in South Africa, and the police cannot always be there to protect us. So in talking about the COVID infringement of a right to carry weapons, I'm concerned that perhaps a fear of wrongful arrest, prosecution, and victimization may lead some people not to be armed. some law-abiding civilians. And if that happens, won't this lead to less armed law-abiding people? Then also looking on the effect on law enforcement, the arresting officers will have to make judgment calls on human intentions in very high-pressure situations. Like we established, that will have increased training requirements on lawful and unlawful arrests under the bill. And that will, of course, cost the public tax funds. Then also, if there is a high possibility of unlawful arrests, then I would like us to consider that and put measures in place to prevent that from happening. In looking on how this will be prosecuted, the prosecution, will they have to prove intention to commit a crime for a crime that has not yet happened in reality? And the accused, if I'm accused under this bill, will I have to prove that I did not intend to do something? And how does one prove not intending to do a crime with a dangerous weapon? Then like I said, we need to look at the limits of opportunity for corruption. My concern is that the word of civilians will be placed against the word of the police. And also we have to look at the impact or the unhingement of the power balance between civilians and the state agencies. So I have a number of recommendations that I would like to submit, and the one is to perhaps be more specific on what to prohibit, the brandishing of weapons at protests, for example. And to look at avoiding the language of a blanket prohibition on possession of weapons. And to clarify and explain what constitutes a crime under this bill. And then also to clarify exactly what constitutes legitimate and illegitimate civilian possession and carry of weapons. We also have to consider the social costs and unintended consequences if a COVID infringement were to happen. Would that perhaps be, and like we established, anything can be a dangerous weapon. But if law-abiding civilians are in fact disarmed, or more disarmed under this law, won't some criminals actually find it easier to commit crimes? And then also evaluate the opportunity and wrongful, or the possibility and opportunity of wrongful arrests, extortions, and perhaps framing of civilians. This would, of course, if it were to happen, damage police reputation, which I think is not helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Monslin. Hopefully, by attending today's proceedings, you have realized that your concerns are not justified. The intention is not, with this bill, to unarm South African citizens. And that is why this bill differs hugely from the first draft, where the first draft, you might have those concerns, might have been legitimate. I think we also need to clarify for you that the bill does not intend dealing only with public protests. You said earlier that you're concerned about your wife who carries a knife. It is exactly to protect people like ourselves from a perpetrator in your backyard with what seems to be an innocent tool, but that can be used as an assault, a weapon in an assault. So hopefully most of your concerns by attending have been addressed. Before I take questions from the members, I would like the department to react quickly, and I would also encourage yourself, Mr. Omslin, just to speak to the department afterwards, because I am worried that you might also have had the wrong version of the bill when you did draft your comments, and you won't be the only one. We also saw it from other people that came in that they didn't have the final version of the bill in front of them. They were working from the previous draft. So over to the department first, then I will open for questions.
Chair, first of all, the blanket prohibition on weapons only relates to gatherings. So it's the blanket prohibition of anything that can be considered a weapon is related specifically to gatherings. Otherwise, it's about intention. I hear what you're saying about civilian versus police, but that happens in law all the time. Intention to commit a robbery, it's the civilian's word against the police, and it's who the court would say has the reasonable... Because I think we need to distinguish here. The police officers do not convict. The police officers make the arrest. It is the court that convicts. It's the Justice Department that prosecutes and the court that convicts. And in those situations, the police have to have an objective legal reason to make that arrest. And then after that, it is the court that decides on that. So an arrest is not a conviction, and I just need to be clear on that. And it happens all the time. That it's the civilian word against the police in any court case, in fact, which is criminal. You have the state, which is represents the police and the Justice Department, and you have the civilian, and that's how it works. I just wanted to say that I'm a bit concerned, Chairperson, and I think we would definitely engage with you about exactly the bill, because I think the Minister's made the intentions very clear. But I also just wanted to raise a concern which has come up a couple of times in the presentations today, and that is about where we legislate for the police acting unlawfully. The police are not the law, they are the enforcers of the law. And if we start legislating, I could decide I don't want to drive in case I'm unlawfully prosecuted for reckless driving or drunken driving. That doesn't mean we must take reckless driving and drunken driving off the statute book. It means that the police must be held responsible for false arrests and where there are false prosecutions. So I just want us to be quite careful about not legislating for unlawful behaviour of the police. That is unlawful in terms of the Criminal Procedures Act, and we've spoken about the need for proper training in terms of this bill. But where an act is unlawful, it's unlawful, and if the police overextend their powers, then they must be dealt with in terms of overextending their powers. And yes, we have recognised that we need to address issues of training, but we can't not legislate unlawful acts because we're scared the police might misinterpret those acts. Otherwise, we'd never have any criminal law in the country. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to refer to the issue in the Finance Control Act. We did mention in the previous meeting. It's an offence since 2000 to be in possession of any firearm, imitation firearm or ammunition with intent to commit an offence. It's very much the same offence that we are dealing with here with in terms of dangerous weapons. So it's not something new, and I don't think we are over-regulating. It's really a matter of taking the safety of the community into account. Thanks, Chair.
I also just wanted to add, for Mr. Van Onselen's benefit, you raised the issue, how do you prosecute something that didn't happen yet? You don't doesn't have to happen for you to be able to prosecute, and I think a good example is the recent arrest of the DRC citizens in our country who were planning to overthrow the DRC government. You don't wait. You know, part of our problem in South Africa is the fact that too much of it happens after the fact. This piece of legislation is trying to prevent horrible incidents of violence from happening. So we want to really allay your fears in terms of what you have. This bill does not disarm law-abiding citizens. I still can choose to have a hockey stick in my car as my preferred self-defense object that I'm using, if that is my choice. It's not illegalizing your wife carrying a knife in order to self-defend. Is there any questions on this presentation, members? Nothing? Mr. Van Onselen, anything else from you? Can I encourage that you do talk to the department afterwards, please? Members, I want to thank you for your time that you've been here. Next week, Tuesday, we have a full day meeting. We're starting off again with the rest of the public hearings, and thereafter we're immediately going into deliberations. So I'm asking the department immediately after the public hearings, I will ask the department on those issues that we have already agreed upon, that there need to be changes, amendments, etc., that you present then next Wednesday, Tuesday immediately after the final public processes that you present on those, and then we will take it through clause by clause from there on. General Jacobs, you want to ask, add something?
Chair, thank you very much. You asked us to draft an implementation plan. We have made a draft and we send it out to the provinces and to the relevant divisional commissioners. Can I just ask that if we could present that in the first meeting in March, that will be okay.
You can present that as long as you have with that implementation plan also the costing of that. Then it's fine. Then we will give you that opportunity for that as well. Members, thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much to the public as well. Thank you. Members, next week's meeting is in E249.